The Off The Ball Podcast Network.
It is 7:30 on this Tuesday morning. You're very welcome along to OTBAM. It's Owen and Johnny with you right the way through until 9:30 this morning. Plenty happening. A lot of interesting stories in the newspapers on a national and a local level this morning.
You should be reeling. How are you so professional?
You know,
is this the first time your kind of journalistic credentials have been castigated in the media?
I don't see my journalistic credentials being called out anywhere.
What's happened?
More on that later. The Mayo News have reported comments from Mayo GEA, which we will get to in the newspapers this morning.
We daren't, anything we want to hear about.
We daren't prioritise any other newspaper story ahead of any other one. Busy show. We've got a retro jersey segment coming up later on with Richie McCormack.
I like that.
Yeah, so do I. The thing is, I've got a terrible sense for the retro jersey. I often need to be told what is nice, and then I realise, oh, yeah, that's a pretty nice jersey. If you had to buy one retro jersey this Christmas, Johnny, what would you buy? I realise I'm putting you on the spot here.
Ooh, my favourite retro jersey is genuinely one I actually have. It's like a Galway United jersey from the mid-90s. After that, the Liverpool away jersey, the Carlsberg dark green with the three stripes coming down here from about 94, maybe, because that was the first Liverpool jersey I bought, £26 at the time in Mount Bellew. Ireland Italian 90 jersey was a classic as well, but I've made this point on the show a few times. There are far too many jerseys nowadays. They come out They come out like every year, which I think is wrong, because you just forget them straight away. Like they don't have any time to become iconic, I suppose, and I don't like the fact that it's just, oh yeah, we have a jersey every year now.
What's your view on the retro jerseys being kind of remade for modern purposes, like the Arsenal bruised banana one, which is obviously being used in away games, and is kind of more of a classic look?
Yeah,
Is it a bit of a cop-out, basically?
It is a bit, like... Just don't make jerseys as often and make them good. Like, Bowes have come out with a great jersey this year, and it's really, really nice. And you'd hope that would set in for 2 or 3 years now, not just change again next year, because you'll just forget about it. But what's your favourite, like, jersey maker?
Adidas. Yeah, the three stripes. I know, like, O'Neill's managed to... I don't know what they did, but they managed to skew the rights, and they managed to get the three stripes.
Yeah, I could never figure that out,
for the Kerry jersey.
Maybe Adidas nicked it off O'Neill's. I doubt it, though.
Well, possibly, yeah. Actually. You could be digging into a conspiracy theory there.
Who knows?
What constitutes retro? How far back do you have to go retro? Because, like, if you're thinking about iconic jerseys, like, I never would have considered, say, Ireland's 2002 Aircom jersey as an iconic one. And then it showed up, remember, there was a Japanese model who was wearing the Aircom jersey in a shoot in Tokyo there last year, I think it was. And all of a sudden you're thinking, maybe this is iconic, and you just don't appreciate it.
It probably is retro, like, 2002, 17 years ago? Yeah, it's retro in my book anyway. Nice segment of the show though.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Richie's going to be in. He's been chatting to Ger about that. So if you've got any Christmas presents still yet to buy, and you think somebody might like a jersey or two, Richie will have a few ideas for you. We're going to get stuck in as well to some of the sports photos of the year a little bit later on with Brendan Moore. And there's a new ESRI report out looking into the demands of intercounty players. To give you the full title of the report, we're going to have Ailish Kelly with us a little bit later on. It's Safeguarding Amateur Athletes, an Examination of Player Welfare Among Senior Intercounty Gaelic Players. It's probably the big breaking news this morning. I can go through the rest of the coming up there. The sports page is coming in just a way. Football at 8:05. The best guides, as we've already mentioned, at 8:20. After that, then the sports news at 8:25. The season of Sundays, as I've already mentioned, at 8:50. And then talking points at 9:15. So we'll get into the ESRI in just a moment. Let's have a look at the back pages.
Yeah, you know when like a newspaper is failing, they just kind of change the font of it. So they've just changed the font from 8:00 AM to kind of to jizz it up a bit, like, but I do like it actually. Looks a lot different. It's changed in the last 2 weeks.
Well, I've been a newspaper. It is actually, yeah. Yeah, have you not been in the studio in the last?
I was in once, but I was kind of shouted down. But you know the way it's like, oh, we need to do something, so let's change the front of the paper, let's change the font, or let's change the size of the paper. OTBAM is thriving.
Compared us to a failing newspaper.
Yeah, but no, I really like it. I really, really like. What is the font type?
You're asking the wrong guy here. I couldn't tell you what a nice retro jersey is, let alone what a font type is. It's not Comic Sans, is all I can tell you.
Well, I start with the star.
Go for it.
Carlo Rising, Everton poised to appoint Ancelotti. So it looks like he's back. He's going to come back. And then, obviously, this Ross turns down a 10 million FEI request. So this is going to be all over the papers today, that the FEI have been told by the government that we're not kind of bailing you out to the tune of 10 million, which is... understandable, I suppose.
Yeah, more on that in a moment. Back page of the Mirror is Lottie Potty. The Lottie headline is in relation to Carlo Ancelotti. He's closing in on Goodison hot seat after Everton Chiefs plan, amazing coup. And City fury after Arteta's late night Gunners meeting. And then I have a couple of headlines from Zaha's stunning equaliser last night for Crystal Palace against Brighton. And it's for Real this time. Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola handed an explosive Champions League reunion with old foes Real Madrid.
Amazing coup was interesting because he is a manager that's getting on a bit, and the Napoli thing didn't exactly work out. But this is the Irish Daily Mail. Again, the FAI's 10 million snub. Snub might be a little bit harsh considering the position they're in. Ruby Walsh, I've scratched that itch and I'm not going back. That's from a Paddy Power sponsored podcast in the Boar's Head that was attended by journalists. He said, I'm kind of done with it. Kearney fails to make the grade for Farrell. I was actually asking Alan Quinlan about this, was it last week, just is he going to make some really ruthless calls, and I suppose that's the start of them, if you'd even call it ruthless.
Irish Examiner is names in the frame. Who's in pole position on the road to Istanbul? Going nowhere, Leinster dismissed Sexton's move to Lyon, which was obviously linked and floated yesterday. Internal dispute, concerns expressed over fundamental integrity of the Cork County Board, while Kearney holds on as chairman of Galway County Board. Club legend, meanwhile, Kevin Markham discusses Waterville, the greats in the retirement with Noel Cronin, and a footballing crisis. Sports Minister Shane Ross says FAI sought €10 million bailout.
Back of the hurl, time to step up. Klopp keeping close eye on Poole's Irish kid Kelleher, who's expected to start against Villa tonight, and a big game for Creven Kelleher as he attempts to kind of force his way into, if not the Liverpool scene, at least kind of gain a bit of experience. And end of an era as Kearney left out, which we've explained.
Irish Independent has a cracking story on the back page. Michael Verney, Galvin faces player backlash after wielding Wexford axe. I'll give you the details on that in just a moment, because they've got a couple of other stories here as well. Everton confident of securing Ancelotti to replace Silva, and Farrell discards Kearney as he names his first training squad.
Is that Stuart Lancaster with James Horne?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, for anybody who didn't see that, I forgot to mention that. It is printed on the back page of the Irish Independent. James Horne went to Leinster training yesterday. Pictured as well with Leo Cullen. Like, we've seen this happen quite a bit, not just with coaches, both with GEA players. Johnny Cooper, of course, spent a bit of time in the Leinster camp as well last year. And James Horne, the latest to go in and seek a bit of advice. Like, you don't want to take too much of a leap. He's clearly just going in to get a bit of an outlook on high-performance setups. But, like, asking Leo Cullen the question about, you know, you were bridesmaids to Munster for quite a while. How did you manage to turn it around in Leinster? Like, as I said, I don't want to dig too much into it. I'm sure at face value it's just like looking at high performance. But there is a small bit of a parallel between the rise of Leinster and where perhaps Mayo are at the moment.
Small.
They're certainly perhaps not achieving what they want to achieve or haven't done in living memory. And that's certainly something that Leinster were at before they took over and they became the dominant province.
Vinnie Perth actually was in earlier this year with them as well. This is the back of the Guardian. Lovely feature on the Dancing Sisters. A remarkable story. And also a sick joke. Italian football's new own goal in their anti-racism campaign. They just cannot get this right at all in Italy. And it's just getting worse as well. So plenty of reading in the Guardian.
Irish Times. Madrid Giants will push Liverpool and Manchester City to the limit, while Scottish club can reach final, says Neil Lennon. Celtic face Copenhagen in the last 32. While Manchester United draw Club Brugge.
Madrid are 20-1 to win the Champions League. I just saw that today. I was like, when was the last time Real Madrid were 20-1 to win the Champions League? Mm-hmm. It's kind of mad. I was looking at the betting now. Liverpool have closed in on Man City at the top. There's very little between them.
Yeah.
Because I don't think either of them has been utterly outstanding this season. But and obviously Pogba featured on the back of the Sun. I saw this myself yesterday. He was doing a little dance at his brother's wedding. Yeah, I kind of feel sorry for him to an extent, because his video of him at his brother's wedding, which is obviously a personal occasion, is on social media, and then he's photographed with his dog out, Take Pog Out, just a play on the dog, I suppose. Croc star back in the groove, and then about Arteta and Ancelotti's moves, and that's the back of the Sun.
The Times leads with the Arteta story. Arsenal close in on deal to land Arteta. 9-month ban for Rob Howley, and Sky to review stump Mike Hughes in their cricket coverage. That's it for these. We'll just show you the Mayo News. Oh, sorry, Racing Post.
We have to get to the Mayo News, really, don't we? But this is the front of the Racing Post. This is something we probably won't have time to get into here, but Santa delivers. All favourites won at Plumpton yesterday, page 5. And I thought what was a little bit... there was a nice symmetry to this, because when you go to the actual story on page 5, bookmaker Woe, as all seven Plumpton favourites oblige, and this is kind of symptomatic of the problems facing on-course bookmakers at the moment. But below that, turnover and profits soar as Bet365 posts strong set of accounts, and Bet365 online gambling turnover nearly breached the 3 million mark. So that's a story for another day, but racing is in a tricky place at the moment in terms of betting.
That's you done?
That's me done.
We will just have a look at the Mayo News, and we're not going to spend too long on it. This is obviously great coverage across the newspaper this morning, which is out in Mayo, of the county convention at the weekend.
Great coverage.
This is, well, within the Mayo News, PRO slams radio broadcaster video. It's just a story, I suppose, we just have to mention here. It's Gerard Flanagan's story. So for anybody who hasn't seen this, returning Mayo GAA PRO Paul Canan has criticised the national radio broadcaster who he claims made a mockery of Mayo GAA during the reporting of a county board meeting last month. So this is remarkable. In his acceptance speech after defeating Ballycroy's Michael Gallagher for the post of public relations officer, Canan took issue with Newstalk's Off the Ball for their reporting of an emergency Mayo GAA meeting of club delegates early last month. The video in question, posted to the Off the Ball Twitter page, received over 166,000 views.
And counting.
No, it was that much, to be quite honest. On the night of the meeting, which was, I did it actually.
Updated every day.
Which was called due to the escalating row with the Mayo GAA International Supporters Foundation. I'm not sure, was this actually in his acceptance speech?
No one likes to see GAA in the Mayo GAA in the headlines. I mean, what?
Says
Canan. Surely they want to be in the headlines for some reason.
Ultimately, it's not my name or the officer's name. It's Mayo GAA's name, and no one wants to see Mayo in the headlines. We had an instance during the year where a radio broadcaster sent a reporter down to a meeting and made a mockery of Mayo GAA. I mean, how dare you do that to us? How dare you treat Mayo GAA like that? For some content in social media to make an absolute fool out of us, and how we do our business just because we're having an emergency meeting with our clubs. That's no way for the media to conduct themselves either.
Right there.
Certainly we haven't done things right, but we do a lot of good things, and a lot of the officers have outlined some of the good things that we do today. So,
I think there's a glaring omission in the whole article. Your bloody name. I mean, are you too big to piss off now after the year you've had?
I think, to be honest with you, there could be another video that was done, perhaps. He hasn't specified. There could be numerous 166,000 view videos that have been done this year.
If we can confirm there, I'm pretty sure it is your video.
The only thing I really hope for here is that this was actually done in his acceptance speech to the whole people of Mayo.
Yeah, like golden cleric speech.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Very, very golden
use
cleric.
Use it to settle a few, not even old scores, quite fresh scores. I mean, this was only about 6 weeks ago, was it?
About that, yeah.
Did your life change much since?
Hugely. What I would say is that what has been failed to mention here is that this was a meeting, obviously, where media were not allowed to attend. This is a meeting where I sent specific questions to the PRO in question here, and I asked him would he be responding to those questions, and he very flatly said no. I actually even offered Mayo County Board the opportunity to read their pre-prepared statement down the barrel of my camera, or I could even perhaps send questions for them to plan and actually answer questions to, because, you know, I travelled all the way to Mayo and it would be nice to come away with a bit of video.
How did you get down there?
I got the train, actually.
Yeah, got out of Castlebar?
Castlebar. Michaela Park is very accessible. Yeah. So what do you do when you're stuck outside and you've got no content and your crowd has sent you down? To be honest with you, it wasn't even to make video. It was because I was absolutely bored out of my tree.
What's your name again?
My name is Owen Sheehan, Johnny.
Somebody knows your name.
Somebody somewhere does know my name. But that's the Mayo News this morning. Slammed. Yeah, the FAI is also on the back pages this morning. There's a couple of interesting things. Shane Ross saying that they turned down a request from the FAI for a €10 million bailout. 90-minute meeting last night, so it was short and snappy. Brendan Griffin was there, Ross was there, six members of the FAI. Basically, Paul Cook is going to go back to discuss with the Bank of Ireland in terms of their stadium loan. And
this is the thing, Owen, because Paul Cook's tone has changed a bit now, where I think he's probably, in view of what happened yesterday, he's probably embracing reality, where he's kind of... Neil O'Riordan has some very good stuff in The Sun today, which I may mention here. Some of which is to do with the ongoing crisis at the FAI. There's another piece as well where he makes a very valid point that Limerick's demise... Now, we had a Limerick manager, Tommy Barrett, in last week, and this is on page 46 and 47. Limerick's demise, a depressing reflection on the state of the game. And this is a column from Neil O'Riordan. And he says, it's the sort of crisis which in years gone by, former FAI CEO John Delaney would have relished. But he goes into the first vision now, which is in a bit of a dilemma in terms of how many clubs are in the next season. But Limerick's demise made very little news. And we just happened to have Tommy Barrett in here because he happened to be in Dublin. But if you read Paul Cook's comments, he's kind of deviated from, we will restructure our finances, everything will should be okay to, we're talking to Bank of Ireland at the moment and we're kind of seeing what we can do. It looks, from reading the, you know, the papers at the weekend, there was a lot of obviously analysis in the Business Post on Sunday and other papers. It looks increasingly likely that something is going to have to seriously give here. Like, the organisation is going to be rendered completely obsolete, or it's going to split into two or something. Because where are they going to... Michael McDowell's wife, Niamh Brennan, who's she's an expert in corporate governance, she's saying, like, you have no real asset here. Your asset is a stadium that you've kind of a questionable ownership over. Mm. So how can you have a deal with the banks when you have actually no asset to sell as collateral down the line?
That Irish Times article now seems to be the text that everybody is just reading off over the night. Like, it was a brilliant piece, but it almost just kind of clicked with everybody in terms of what it actually is wrong here.
I was quite annoyed. I've had dealings with Niamh before, back in the day when we were looking into kind of some dealings with horse racing. She was brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant, but she simplifies stuff that isn't, you know, that simple either. But it looks, I don't understand, but I can't really see beyond, like, someone saying, listen, you know, I'm going to pass away in the next 10 or 15 years. I have a load of money. Just take 60 million. Because I don't think that's going to happen. So it seems that the FAI is becoming increasingly hopeless as a going concern.
And one of those ideas of what the dawn might be, if there is a dawn, is explored by Declan Lee in the Indo today as well. And New Look FAI still has the potential to be the best show in town for sponsors. So this obviously comes off the back that one of the many, many stories we had over the last couple of weeks was Three pulling their sponsorship, understandably so, from the FAI. Now, they'd say that they wanted to focus on music, of course, and that their sporting portfolio, perhaps, is kind of done and dusted on the football front. But it is, in many ways, a bit of an opportunity. Like, if you accept that the lowest ebb perhaps hasn't happened, but is getting close after that, and after what comes from perhaps a new organisation, like, it wouldn't be the worst sponsorship portfolio to have. It's still a bit of a risk, mind you.
But you're sponsoring the Irish football team.
Like, that's it. You're not sponsoring the FAI.
Do you know what I mean? So as it was anyway, the jerseys that anyone bought for years, for as long as I can remember, much to my annoyance and that of many football fans, when you bought the actual international jersey, it had the sponsors on it, even though the sponsor wouldn't be on it during match night. But I presume you'd be getting a cup price, you'd get a lot of publicity, you'd get at least a week's publicity out of it if you really dragged it out. It's like, well, we're back in, you know, Irish football and blah blah blah. And as I made this point before, Michael O'Leary bought a shitload of planes after 9/11 for good reason, because he was, people for their own absolute stupidity, were afraid of flying because of one day, and he got them at a massive discount, realizing that there was a herd mentality, and it was getting it's a really good opportunity, I think. But I don't know if the FAI is going to be around to even negotiate a deal. I honestly don't know. And think of the League of Ireland as well, Owen. Like, there was a text, I'm in a Galway United, like, match programme WhatsApp group, one of them, millions of WhatsApp groups were all in or whatever. And it's like, do we know how many home games we're playing next season? Absolutely not. Don't know how many teams are in the... Like, it's nearly the end of the year. The season's starting in February, and we don't know the makeup of the League of Ireland next season. Yeah, like, that's a shambles. Imagine the Premier League in sort of June, not knowing how many teams were in it. It's like, and this is just accepted as normal now. It's embarrassing.
I want to move on to a couple of other stories. We'll get to Arteta and Ancelotti in just a moment, but just to touch on the rugby news carried in all the newspapers this morning. This mid-season stock take, the officially termed stock take, one-day training camp. We actually know the squad, the amount of people, the 45 men that are going to be in this group.
This is a departure from the Schmidt era.
It is, actually. There'd often be a lot of whispers, a lot of conjecture about who's in, who's out from these Schmidt camps. But Andy Farrell has actually said, nah, I'm going to do things a little bit differently. We're going to actually say who's in the squad. I know a couple of things he's done differently. No Rob Kearney, no Sean Cronin. And then... perhaps, like, for those reasons, you'd imagine that it's going to be tough for them to get back into the Ireland squad at any point.
As they get older.
But then there's no Jack Carty as well. He's obviously had a poor season with Connacht since he's come back from the World Cup. But no Jordy Murphy is probably the biggest omission, because he's been pretty good, and Ulster have been very, very good. So it's hard to know why that is. But obviously some great opportunities for some young players here. The thing about this, when people think to themselves, right, if there's a couple of injured players who aren't in and around the squad, well, you've got, like, Johnny Sexton involved with the squad at the moment, and you've got this sort of political situation in the background now about who will actually get the captaincy at the moment. And I'm sure this will have no real bearing on it, but I do wonder if behind closed doors at this stock take a captain has been named, and they are proceeding with whoever that the person is that's going to lead Ireland into the Six Nations.
It's not that, what is it away, like 6 weeks or something?
6 weeks, I think, at this point. Maybe seven.
Yeah, so I'm sure he's watching on. The provinces are in very good health generally at the moment, particularly Leinster's strength and depth must be really encouraging to him when they can just change their team and sort of do what, and have the game won after like 5 minutes basically on Saturday. I'm fascinated by, I'm absolutely fascinated by the out-half situation, what he's going to do there. Is it certain that Sexton, who's going to go in there a little bit cold because of his injury, will he be loyal to him? And the Kearney thing is probably not entirely unexpected, but it's not comparable to the FEI, but he is taking over a regime that had probably reached its end, and also that, you know, where Ireland had serious questions to answer for the last year since the New Zealand game, where this year has been not good. And I think he will have to try to bring in his own style of rugby as well. It makes it a lot more expansive, and great time to be taking over. And like last year, we were hot favourites to win the Six Nations. This year, we're like second or third favourites behind England. And there are lots of nice ingredients for him there, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And like when you say about the regime perhaps being tainted by how it ended, but of course, Andy Farrell was part of this. And I know it's only a very small thing actually announcing the stock take team.
But you're suggesting that he's trying to kind of say this is a new regime now, and this is, I'm making a quite pointed difference.
I think so.
Yeah.
And like maybe it's reading too much into whether or not something gets announced, but Joe Schmidt read a lot into the media and read a lot into publicity and what was being said about him and written about him. So I think it's fair game to actually analyse why this has been announced, a bit more transparency and less conjecture. Like it's interesting that you mentioned the situation at 10. Like I would have thought that Johnny Sexton will be Ireland's best out half in the year 2020. Like Joey Carberry's had his injury worries. It's the question of whether or not you get into the next World Cup cycle. Who will be the best out half at the end of the next World Cup cycle? And there is every chance that Joey Carberry will be that guy. But I think it's just a situation of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and getting rid of him too soon if that's the case, because he's in the captaincy mix as well. And possibly the front runner to get the captaincy, I'm not quite sure. We'll have more on that across the Off the Ball channels as the week progresses, of course. Just a couple of last stories we want to get to in the papers, and it's two managerial stories. It is Carlo Ancelotti. You mentioned, I got from your tone at the top of the show that perhaps he's a bit past it in your view.
You can get very ageist with managers now, where, you know, like that's the thing about Palace, and obviously having Roy Hodgson there, he's definitely an outlier. And if you look at the managerial appointments that the FAI made, they went for, apart from Steve Staunton, who was a bit of a gamble, they thereafter went for these proven managers like Mick, Martin O'Neill and Trapp were very much at the latter stages of their career when they took the jobs. And it's like, well, should we not be kind of looking for somebody like Stephen Kenny, for example, that might have new revolutionary ideas? Because I don't think the lads have. Ancelotti, you know, if you look at his Napoli reign, hasn't been an unqualified success. But I suppose for Everton's perspective, he's still a very big name for, you know, when were Everton last in Europe, for example? I can't remember. They're a club that don't really, they're mid-table at best sort of most seasons. They haven't, they've had a very, very poor season. So it is probably a bit of a coup, but I like Ancelotti. I think it'll be interesting. You can never have enough Italian managers, I think, and it'll be interesting to see. And obviously Arteta.
You go get your manager in the middle of the night. Arsenal trying to
with
a lot of subterfuge. Backfired dramatically.
Yeah, where was the photo? It didn't really look like Arteta. What's going on here?
It's not Arteta. It's Arsenal's CEO.
Who is
CEO.
This?
This
is Vini. Okay, so this is like...
That's at Mikel Arteta's house at 2 o'clock in the morning.
So what happened there? Did somebody just like take a chance, or was it like, you know, they got a bit of a rumour that he might go to the house?
Presumably got a bit of a rumour. And Manchester City also got a bit of a rumour because they had no idea until... Well, we're led to believe that they had no idea until those pictures came out. So, like, they're reportedly very annoyed with Arsenal. They're not too annoyed with Mikel Arteta. But still, it takes two to tango in this, and Mikel Arteta had these guys over to his house in the middle of the night. I can't imagine if they broke in and interrogated him. I'd imagine this was this came from both sides. He was up for the conversation. So it looks like that's going to be a bit of a done deal. Kieran in the box says the same thing with Saul Campbell, visited him in the middle of the night to sign for Arsenal as well. So you could say it's definitely happening. But betting has been suspended on Mikel Arteta, but it was suspended on Mikel Arteta as well before Unai Emery got appointed. So it would be quite the U-turn if Arsenal were to screw him over twice. And I don't know, like, I'm kind of surprised that Arteta is just allowing this to happen so easily. I thought that after getting screwed over previously that he would have thought to himself, well, no, I'm not going back to Arsenal. That with the current regime that are there and the current people who run the club, I'm never giving them another chance. And it's also a bit of a risk. Because
well, if it goes badly, his currency is in a bad way, obviously.
The board just need to shut out
everything
that is going to be said or written about him if things don't go well. And I'm talking in 18 months. Like, we could be in 18 months down the line, and it could be a situation where Arsenal are still struggling to maintain their top six position.
Yeah.
But it'll be for the greater good. Like, I really believe that he's one of the best coaches in Europe at the moment. Pep Guardiola doesn't talk nonsense about people unless he truly believes it. And I take Pep Guardiola at face value when he says that this guy is one of the better coaches he's worked with. So
he needs to get a bit of backbone into that team. They've just, like, for so long now, they've lacked proper leaders and proper ability to get the job done and crumble under pressure and all that. One other thing I just want to mention as well is Lincoln in with Zach. Lincoln City bought Zach Elbouzedi from Watford. I think it was the Daily Mail mentioned a reputed fee of 30 grand, which I just think that, like, that sort of stuff really shouldn't be happening anymore. He's a regular Irish under 21 international, and he's a good player. And Watford, who really could do with the money, to be only getting 30 grand is disappointing. And still lots of doubts about Watford next season, what sort of money they'll have, and obviously losing key players. They've lost at least three key players in the off-season, and he's the biggest name. But best of luck to him at Lincoln. He's a very promising player.
Absolutely. And then last story, I presume you've seen the one about Magnus Carlsen.
I haven't, actually.
The Norwegian chess grandmaster, current world champion.
Yeah, fantasy football.
Well, he was, just an update, he is no longer top of fantasy football. He's dropped down to lowly third position after last night's efforts. I would say big congratulations to him. He captained Salah this weekend, which some people perhaps wouldn't have given him
bold the call.
Like, and it's actually a fairly high-profile fantasy football league. He's now been replaced at the top by Nick Tanner, who is a former Liverpool player himself. So,
I remember him, Nick Tanner.
Bristol Rovers as well.
Yeah, that would have been around the time, I think, of that Liverpool away jersey I was talking about.
And Carlson's secret, apparently, is Optidata. So the rest of us plebs obviously don't have access to Optidata, but a Norwegian chess grandmaster can get it, and that's why his team is doing so well. So back in third this morning.
Nicky Tanner, born 1965.
Oh, wow. That's amazing, isn't it? Right, all this week on OTBAM, with thanks to Best Menswear, we've got some prizes and brilliant gift guides each morning to help you in the build-up to Christmas. A little later, we'll be bringing you the guide to buying retro sports jerseys with
Richie McCormack. There it is, actually. There's Nicky Tanner actually wearing the jersey.
Retro jersey, yeah. That is nice.
Yeah, so that was the first jersey I ever bought, £26. And I doubt I had Tanner on the back.
£26 in what year?
I want to say like 94.
That's a lot of money in 1994.
But So Montbellier was about 7 or 8 miles from my house, but I conveniently stopped at all my friend's house on the way home to show it off. Said that, ooh, I've bought a Liverpool jersey, I'm cool.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you were cool.
I was about 17. I was 12 at the time, something like that.
Well, we'll see if Richie has that in his gift guide a little bit later on.
Jersey.
We're also going to have a €150 made-to-wear Best Menswear shirt up for grabs. To enter the draw, we're asking you to send us a photo of your favourite retro sports jersey. It could be Nick Tanner. And send it to us using the hashtag OTBAM. We'll be back with Eilish Kelly right after these.
OTBAM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
Off the ball. Oh, wow. This is aggressive.
I'm washed off the ball. I'm Scottish.
I met a South African last night and he was there. He knew that Dublin won 5 in a row because he watched us off the ball.
Oh.
He really did. And he lives in Thailand.
I've watched Off the Ball on YouTube. Say goodbye.
We love you, and everywhere we follow.
We absolutely love it.
Off the ball. This is OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
From music to rock out to, chill out to, and dance to. From sweater weather to workout playlists. Whatever mood you're in, Go Loud has music to match. Download the Go Loud app now or add us on your smart speaker. Go Loud, podcasts, radio, and music to your ears. Go Loud!
Go Loud!
Merry Christmas, you filthy animal.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
It does seem odd that he hasn't been around and that they're allowing him to get treatment far, far away. I would have thought that Manchester United would have a very strong team of physios and medical people here that could treat, that have seen it all before. It seems very strange that they would allow one of the most...
Valuable assets,
a very phrase to float about and do his own thing many, many miles from Manchester. It seems odd, but you know, I think we will see. We have to presume we will see him back in the United team before the end of this season and then evaluate whether they need another midfield player. I think Fred has settled down into a much more effective player than what we saw in the early part of this season and last season. And McTominay has become such a key man. Did they need another player in there? Of course they would need another player that would add to that. But at the moment, I think the pair of them are doing quite well. And if they had Pogba, would give them another option. He lacks consistency, but maybe within this team, I mean, it appears they've got back some of the values that most people thought were very important to Manchester United, and you know, Pogba doesn't always fit with that, I would say.
Yeah, Brian Kerr in conversation with Stephen Doyle at Old Trafford at the weekend. The full piece available now on youtube.com/offtheball. Right, as we mentioned at the top of the show, there's a brand new ESRI report in conjunction with the GPA and GAA. It's called Safeguarding Amateur Athletes, an examination of player welfare among senior intercounty Gaelic players. And I'm delighted to say that Eilish Kelly of the ESRI is with us in studio. You're very welcome, Eilish.
Thank you.
So we had you in studio last year for the 2018 report, which was basically to lay the groundwork, in my opinion, of the impact of playing GAA. This is basically the same data, just a bit more of a deeper dive.
Exactly. So the first study that was published last year was looking at, you know, what were the commitment levels that players are given to the sport. And I suppose what we identified there, that was on average players are allocating about 32 hours a week to their inter-county commitments. Now, as we said that time, this is very much a baseline measure because we couldn't capture every single commitment that players are given in that study, nor could you capture the mental aspect of preparation for a game or post-game either. So that was the idea that study. The reason that the GAA and the GPA commissioned this study was to take a more micro-analysis looking at maybe decisions players are making around their career, education decisions, professional career. We also want to look at alcohol consumption, usage of supplements, because obviously that's a growing area within the game. And we also looked at the supports that players are receiving, satisfaction levels of those supports, and also what players might change about the intercounty experience or the setup.
We'll get into, I think, education and careers and supplements. They're kind of the three areas that I'm interested in. The alcohol thing has got a lot of headlines this morning. Just briefly mention that, explain to us the statistic and if it's worrying or not.
Okay, so I suppose what we're finding is that effectively players are a subsection of the general population, so that the consumption levels are similar to the non-playing population. So it's about 85-86% of that. But what we're finding is that when players consume alcohol, they're consuming higher quantities of alcohol. So 9 out of 10 players are binge drinking during the off-season, and it's also higher during the pre-season as well. But as I said, the numbers are similar to the general male population. It's just that when they do consume alcohol, they're consuming higher quantities of alcohol. Obviously, that's not good for an individual's health. So I suppose it's to identify, is there any association between the commitment levels that players are getting that was identified in the last report and potentially not having enough of downtime or an off-season that it's given rise.
Joe Canning has talked about this, and I don't necessarily think this is anywhere near the biggest story coming out of the report, but it is quite interesting in that some managers and kind of setups basically have a somewhat autocratic regime where it's like you can't have a pint for like 6 months, and then when they do go out, obviously they're apt to like have quite a few drinks just to let go. And whereas like you'll have lots of Premier League players who will have a couple of drinks at the weekend, and it's a lot more relaxed regime. So I think that's quite interesting, and I'm not sure if that's changed much in that like players are given a little bit more kind of leeway. But this notion of and clubs like having that you can't have a pint now for the next 3 or 4 months, that should not be the case. Players should be allowed to live their own lives. They're not professionals. And I think that is quite interesting.
Yeah, certainly. It's kind of like a releasing of the valve almost when it comes to the off-season, and it's more concentrated. But as I say, we do want to focus on education and professional careers. The first statistic that sticks out is that intercounty players are more educated, or certainly a third level education, than the general male population. Why do you think this is?
Okay, so I suppose just put this in a little bit of context. So what we wanted to do, as I said, was look at, you know, the education decisions that players are making. But I suppose we didn't want to look at them in isolation because we could identify a particular statistic, but we wanted to know, well, how does that compare to the general population? So we're able to use census data and some other CSO data on earnings and that to look at that part of the report. So we used the census 2016 data to look at education levels and also fields of study. So as you mentioned there, that, you know, the players are quite highly educated. We didn't ask or were able to identify from the data the reasons for that. I suppose some hypothesis might be that, you know, these are highly driven individuals. These are the players who are playing at the top of the game. So if they're driven in their sport, they're likely to be driven in their professional career and their education as well. So it could be, you know, that that's the reason that that's given rise to the higher education levels among players. It could also be due to, would say, for example, we know that that individuals from certain socioeconomic backgrounds are more likely to attend third level. The player population could be more likely to be from those particular backgrounds that sure. You have, there's more of them attending third level. It could also be then, I suppose, demand side factors. And by that I mean, is it that certain colleges are enticing more players now to attend colleges because they want to win some of the more prestigious third level competitions like your Sigerson Cup or that. So there could be a combination of factors. You also have the grants that's thrown in there, or the scholarships a lot of universities and colleges are offering to players now as well. Is that attracting, we'll say, players who might not necessarily have gone on to third level to pursue third level education courses? So as I said, it could be a combination of those factors that's given rise to the higher education levels. But it is a significant difference between, as I said, over 60% compared to 30% having a third level qualification or above is quite a big number.
Have we established then, when they get to third level, the quality of the education they're getting in terms of the hours they're spending in lecture halls? I presume that then that's a lower rate to the general third level attending population.
Yeah, so interesting, again, we were able to look at the courses that players are doing versus the general population. We were able to use Higher Education Authority data, HEA data, to look at the number, the hours to their study. There's not a huge difference there, but I suppose where the difference is the courses that players are studying. So you have much higher percentages of players who are studying education, arts and humanities, so they're overrepresented in those fields. So for example, education, you've 26% of players are studying education. That compares to about 7% again of the general male population, right, of the similar age. So they're underrepresented in what we would call the STEM subjects, so your science, technology, engineering and manufacturing. So there's a significant underrepresentation of players in those, possibly because they're leading to careers that have longer working hours, which isn't conducive to playing senior inter-county. But I suppose from a player's perspective, it is just about education. And at the end of the day, players are going to make the decision whether or not they want to give the commitments. But it's just important to educate them that the decisions they're making will have implications in terms of earnings and also their career for when they finish playing the game.
Yeah, like it is simplistic to say it, but it is truth. It's represented in the statistics that people are picking certain careers because it allows them to train better. It's less arduous in the body. You have weekends off, you have evenings off, and it leads into all of that. Like, do you get a sense then that people are perhaps regretting their decision later down the line after their intercounty career?
Okay, so the first thing we did was, or one of the first questions we asked of the players was, you know, what was the main factor that determined what they did after leaving second level of education? So we asked players, did they do something because it was something that they were interested in? They did pick, we'll say, the job or education course because it was going to lead to the job that they wanted. Did they do it because it was going to facilitate them to play intercounty? And we also gave them the option to tell us what was the main factor. So I suppose one of the interesting finding there is that you're finding just over 26% of players indicated that the course that they selected or the job was to facilitate them to play intercounty. So quite a proportion of individuals at that stage, and bearing in mind that this is 2016, players were deciding on what they were doing after second level to actually facilitate them to play intercounty. We then also asked them a question, if they could go back again, would they select the same career path? And you get over 40% of players indicated that they would not, right, select the same career path. But again, the question you might ask is, well, is that high? Because straight away you think 40% sounds, yeah, like a lot. So again, we were lucky that we had data for the general population of males of similar age, and it's about 36%, which, okay, again, so there's not a huge difference. But what we are finding in the research is that those players that selected their course or career to be able to facilitate them to play inter-county. It's much higher. It's over 50% for that group of individuals. So when you take those out of the player data, you actually get players to be similar to the general male population of similar age in terms of levels of regret about what they did after your, second level.
Your point earlier when some of the Wexford players, when you said their career might be over now, and we call it a career, but yeah. It's playing amateur sport, whereas your career is what you're actually doing and being earning money for. And I think what's interesting that an awful lot of Gaelic players are choosing, we'll say, to become to work in teaching or whatever, and these are not necessarily high salary jobs, so down the line that may stymie them in terms of, I don't know, getting a mortgage, like where they can live and so forth. And obviously your career in Gaelic games now is over quite early. I mean, your inter-county career is over at 30 for most players or thereabouts. So, but you don't think of that, I suppose, when you're 18. And that's... Yeah. That was my main finding from it anyway.
Yeah, so just to follow up on that then, like we were able to look at, you know, what were the occupations, what were the sectors of employment that players were going into. And again, we used a CSO's Survey of Income and Living Conditions data to compare with the general population. And you find that much higher proportions of players are going into the public sector, and it's predominantly into education that these individuals are going into. And their hours of work are lower, so they're working about, those players who go into the public sector, their average number of hours per week is about 35 hours, which is lower than their counterparts that are gone into private sector, which is about 40 hours a week, and also lower compared to the non-playing population that goes into the public sector. So they are working lower hours. We also looked at earnings. On average, players' median income is slightly higher than the general male population of the same age. But when you look at it by education levels, those that have higher levels of education are earning significantly less, as are those working in the public sector, as are those who are working full-time. So there is a trade-off in terms of playing and players' earnings at that point in time.
Right, OK, that's an interesting point. So that would lead to kind of the suggestion now that when it comes to reimbursement for expenses or all that sort of thing, that's of vital importance because there is a financial sacrifice on occasion. They can't, like even people within education, for example, they can't work the extra hours to make a bit of extra cash. They got to go and train. So that becomes a highly important thing from the GPA's perspective and the GEA's perspective.
Okay, so in that regard, though, what we weren't able to look at in the study is how much potentially that's being compensated for by the, we'll say, the government grant that players get, or the expenses, or the gear, or if you want to take those sort of benefits into consideration or that as well. So we weren't able to look at how much, we'll say, that those supports the players are receiving are offsetting the income. Nor, I suppose it's important to bear in mind that we are looking at players at a particular point in time. We don't know once players finish playing inter-county, has that ability to play inter-county, will it actually lead them to other jobs, better jobs, because they're identified as an inter-county player after they finish
and
playing the game?
Anecdotally, you'd imagine it does, unless, you know, they're recognisable and it's like, well, I'd be happy to give him a job because he's a high achiever in some shape or form as well.
Well, I suppose it's a good question. We can't answer it with that data because we don't look at them post-playing. But what we do look at is we did ask players that are playing the game, did they feel that the job did they feel that playing inter-county facilitated them to get the job? And there is, as you might expect, variation across the playing level. So we'll say players from the higher playing levels, so your Division 1 footballers and your McCarthy Cup hurlers, will say yes, they felt that being an inter-county player facilitated them to get a job. But what we don't know from that question, is it because they're an inter-county player and an employer decided I'd like you working for me, or was it a case potentially that the individuals got a job because whether it was the county manager or the county board might have spoken to employer because they might have got a job in a local area that will again facilitate them to be near training.
Sure.
So we don't know what's given rise to that effect, I suppose, but we just know that there is variation. So while you might assume that, oh, because you're an inter-county player, this is going to stand to me when I stop playing, you're not necessarily going to get equality across the playing level, so it's not necessarily going to be of benefit to all players in that regard.
Yeah, it makes sense. Like we've mentioned alcohol, but it's kind of in the same section as the supplements here. Some of the statistics here, I'm not sure whether they're surprising or not surprising, like the fact that 81% of players in 2016 took supplements. Like when I saw that statistic at the start, I was actually kind of surprised to see it.
Yeah.
But perhaps it actually makes sense when you think about the strength and conditioning that goes on in the off season.
Yeah, so I suppose, just to again give context, when we originally gathered the data for this study, we conducted workshops with the players, and we just thought it was interesting that some of the players made the point that going back 15, 20 years ago, a player would have just maybe taking a cortisone injection without necessarily questioning it, because it's a bit like, okay, this is going to facilitate me to play the game. Obviously, there's been a lot of changes over time. We now have a medical doctor that's part of most teams, and there's more awareness about, we'll say, I suppose, what players are, assistance players will get to be able to play the game when they're injured. And this particular player rose the point that he felt that today supplements is a bit like cortisone, what cortisone injections was like 15 or 20 years ago, that players might be taking them without enough consideration being given to what they're actually putting into their bodies. So as you said, though, it's not surprising because strength and conditioning is such a big part of the game. Now, it's also that the levels these players are training at. But you ask any nutritionist or dietitian and they will always recommend as much as possible to get your what you need from a regular diet, like your protein from your chicken or whatever else. But obviously, there are times when players aren't able to do that. So supplements is highly used within the sport.
Because the nutritionist is not supplying these supplements, or even are they recommending the supplements because they're being taken or being purchased from outside of the intercounty setup, obviously.
Yeah. So the supplements, as you mentioned there, there's a high proportion of players using supplements, and quite a number will say that they're recommended to do so by a member within the intercounty team. So whether that's the manager, the nutritionist, or who we group them as
one. We don't know, the manager could be going off on his own, telling the player to be.
It's more than likely though the nutritionist that it's a bigger proportion of players that are, because again most teams now have a nutritionist as part of the intercounty setup. But I suppose where you do find variation is that there's quite high levels of supplement usage among the lower playing levels where there's less monitoring going on. So in terms of drug testing and that, if drug testing, for example, is just focusing on your top tier players, there might be more of a need to make sure that it's across all playing levels because the monitoring is lower among the lower playing levels.
That's very interesting, because when I immediately looked at it, I was like, well, of course, there's going to be a huge awareness of anti-doping and potentially contaminated substances because of the Brendan O'Sullivan case a couple of years ago. But that case actually occurred after this data was sought. That was 2017, if I remember correctly.
It was in around that time, I think.
Right, so it might have had some sort of impact on the survey that they might have actually... Because I'd imagine if I was an intercounty player and I saw that story come out, I'm hugely cautious of every single thing I'm putting in my body, especially from supplements.
Yeah, and in that regard, what we find, quite a high proportion of players, as you mentioned, is using them. A lot of them have been recommended to do so by the intercounty management team, as in not the manager per se, but the background team. And quite a proportion of players are actually sourcing their supplements from the internet. So again, it's about an education piece because of the fact that unintentionally, it could be in a lot of cases that these individuals may or may not be, if they're sourcing them from the internet, in terms of contaminated substances, that there will be a concern there. Mm. So I know Sports Ireland give a lot of guidance in that regard. I know also that there's a website where players can go in and they can put in the product and they can identify whether or not that there's any of the substances within it and whether or not they're on a banned list or not. So there is more education needed around that whole area of supplement uses and where you're sourcing your supplements because of the knock-on effects of potentially getting a contaminated product. And not only will that have an impact on the player's own physical health, but obviously if a person is drug tested and they're found...
You did some studies on drug testing as well in terms of how often they're drug tested into it.
Yeah, so I mean, we know that GA players are... There's a quite high level of them, would say, compared to other sports, but the figures are actually still quite low, and I suppose it's higher among your top tier players, but it's lower among lower playing levels or that, so there's possibly that's an area that can be looked at as well.
What about the ages of the players taking the supplements? Because obviously there's perhaps some long-term drawbacks to taking supplements, especially if you're using them too young. Don't know the ins and outs of the science, but perhaps if you're in a very controlled intercounty environment and you're fully developed as a human being, it might just be a better situation to take a supplement.
Yeah, so my two colleagues that worked on the report, Conor Keegan and Brendan Walsh, so Brendan looked at, which is really interesting, he looked at the age the players start to taking supplements at, and what he found in that regard is that the older players on the team probably started in their early mid-20s to take supplements, but it's the younger players now that are coming into the teams, they're taking them at a much lower level and in some cases lower than what the GAA recommend in their own guidelines about when players, first of all, I should say the GA and the GPA will say that, again, players, they should be sourcing their their nutrition from natural sources. But if players are going to be engaging in supplement usage, that it should be a certain age. And what the research is showing is that the younger players are taking supplements at a much younger age. So, I mean, that is something that needs to be monitored, because I don't know that enough work has been done yet about the longer term implications of taking supplements on individuals.
I guess it's kind of a nationwide thing at the moment. There's such a supplement culture in rugby, especially in the mid to late teens, people in schools, rugby essentially. It's impossible to think that hasn't actually transferred over to schools. Yeah, GAA.
The first thing you think about when it's like, you know, this, the school's game in rugby, because it's so absolutely so obvious.
Yeah, like the whole bigger is better culture. I know I hadn't actually, I'm not sure if it's included in the report or not, the idea of players getting bigger earlier, because you see it with like minors and stuff, like the muscle mass they're putting on. Even if you compare from when the survey was done to the last couple of years, it's very noticeable. I'm not sure, is there even anecdotal evidence of the impact of that?
Yeah, we don't know that. And I suppose that's an interesting point, because just when we talk about drug testing and everything else, we'll say it's done at the senior level. So there's obviously, we don't know what the situation is for your minors or your under 20s, whether that be a club or inter-county level. And as you mentioned, that at least when you see players on a pitch now, they appear bigger builds. But again, is what is happening at that level for those individuals in terms of, you know, what supplements are they taking, what proportions are of those individuals are taking supplements. So I suppose that's for further work.
In an overall sense then, Eilish, what would the players change? Did you get a sense of if they could perhaps alter one thing in the GAA, what would it be?
Yeah, so this I suppose we find it interesting, because in some ways the report comes full circle. So, you know, at the beginning we look at education, professional career, then we go on and look at alcohol use and supplements, and then we ask players about their satisfaction levels with the supports that they're receiving through the player charters, what would they like to see more emphasis on. And in that regard, the two areas that they identified is that they'd like to see how they might be able to progress their professional career, and secondly, how to keep their inter-county participation in perspective. And they're saying there's more to life than playing inter-county. That's not us putting those words out there. That was the way the question was phrased, and you had a high percentage of players selecting those two areas. And then we, at the very end of the survey, we would give players an opportunity to give feedback about if they had an opportunity to change one thing about their inter-county experience, what would that be, and also in terms of the inter-county setup. And I suppose what we find is that maybe if some of the issues that they've highlighted in this section was addressed, you might not necessarily be getting some of the education or professional career results. So in that regard, players said that they'd like a more fixed season and a shorter playing season, and also to know actually when the season was. They'd like a reduction in the time commitments that included the amount of time travelling to and from the different trainings. And the third main factor was they'd like to see a reintroduction of enjoyment back into the game, which was an interesting point.
That was the biggest, like, what does that mean? Because, you know, enjoyment. So a lot of it isn't enjoyable. And this is, I mean, I think Horan was saying in his little piece, he was saying, you know, amateurism is sacrosanct in the GAA. And this is all nominal amateurism, because it's more than vaguely professional. It's professional in so many ways, obviously, you know.
Yeah, so I suppose maybe players themselves feel that there's a rebalance. And I mean, the fact that they selected out the fact that they would like to know more about how they can keep their inter-county participation in perspective, and the fact that they also said that they'd like to see the reintroduction of enjoyment back into games. Obviously, some players feel that maybe it's a bit imbalanced at the minute. And I mean, there's other findings from the first study and this study that would feed into that as well, about the amount of or lack of downtime that players get, not getting time to spend with family or friends. Those sort of factors aren't sustainable long run. Neither is it the career that they would say that, okay, short term they're able to balance the two of them. But we know again from the first study that the main reason when players step away from the game that they do so is because they want to focus on their professional career. So some individuals might perceive players and the amount of commitment that they give as irrational, not being rational, but they are rational individuals, because they know it gets to a certain stage in their lives where it's not sustainable to keep the two of them going. And why did they step away? It's because they want to focus on their professional careers. And as you mentioned earlier on about the age profile, obviously if the time commitments continues on an upward trajectory, you'll possibly see a reduction in terms of the average age that players stay playing too. And I mean, is that sustainable for the game? Is that the direction that the games want to be going in? That's, I suppose, for the organisation.
If you want to stay amateur, the answer to that question is no. Like, I presume what happens now is that the GPA and GAA analyse this data and think if there's anything they can do on an overall sense, because you look at the horse bolting at the moment, and if you let every county look after their own affairs themselves, especially when it comes to inter-county teams, yeah. This would only get worse. If you do a survey next year, it will the minutes will probably be higher, the commitment levels will probably be larger. But if there is an overall national crackdown on this sort of thing, especially at certain times of the year, this time of the year, for example, we might have some sort of improvement.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you give players an off season, and if you give them a fixed time period, as I said, that would potentially help in terms of some of the issues that was identified in the first part of the study.
Sure. I think it's just that the top teams are at such a high level, and everyone has to raise their standard to be there. It's impossible to not do it 100%.
That's it.
Yeah.
That means for a lot of counties that have no chance really of winning anything, that I've spoken to players playing for some of the smaller clubs, some of the smaller counties, it just didn't make sense for them to commit because their lives were basically gone for the year.
Yeah, and I suppose at the end of the day, and we always say this, it's an amateur sport. Individuals are going to make their own decision whether or not they want to commit, give the commitment level. So it is just about educating them and making them aware of what the implications are of the decisions that they're making, and just for them to maybe, obviously there's a big proportion of them are thinking beyond their career, but there's obviously a proportion that are focusing specifically on being able to play the game, and it's just to make a realisation that this is an amateur sport. You are going to be able to pay for a particular period of time. Be privileged in some way that you can play it, because anyone that's been involved in the games will know how much you get back from the sport, but also bear in mind that there is a life after inter-county and you need to be able to take that into consideration.
And I'd say
it's
fairly incompatible with the big multinationals now for an inter-county player to try to want to work for someone like that big that has demands on you in terms of hours and all that. I'm speculating, but I'd say it's next to impossible to do that.
I'd say the late hours and all that, it's just clearly...
Yeah, well, I mean, the players will tell you again, and it's in the report itself, we asked them about promotion prospects, and there is a certain proportion of players that will say that it is having an impact on their promotion prospects. And again, from the workshops that we conducted with the players, that was coming through as well, that they just felt that they can't give the hours that's needed if they want to progress up the career ladder in their workplace. But they're making the decision, obviously, to play inter-county. Mm-hmm. But again, that's obviously going to have implications in terms of earnings at that point in time for the individuals.
And future earnings as well when it comes to the promotions that you missed out on in your 20s and early 30s. But it's interesting stuff. Eilish, thanks many for popping into the studio.
Thank you.
Eilish Kelly of the ESR. There. Right, all this week on OTB AM, with thanks to Best Menswear, we've got prizes every single morning to help you in the build up to Christmas. To enter the draw this morning, send us a photo of your favourite retro jersey using the hashtag OTBAM. You'll be in the draw for a €150 voucher, a made to measure Best Menswear shirt. Sorry, a €150 made to measure Best Menswear shirt. And now Ger spoke to Richie McCormick, who gave us his gift guide on his best retro sports kit to pick up for your loved ones this Christmas.
Right, don't worry, we've got you covered. Best Menswear have the men in your life sorted this Christmas. They've got gifts from top brands like Hugo Boss, Tommy Hilfiger, Calvin Klein and Marco Capelli, and gifts from as little as €20. All this week in OTBM, with thanks to Best Menswear, we've got prizes every morning to help you in the build-up to Christmas. Anybody who enters the draw this morning, just send us a photo of your favourite retro jersey using the hashtag OTBAM, and you're going to be in for a draw for €150 made-to-measure Best Menswear shirt. This morning, Richie McCormick is here with his gift guide on the best retro sports kit to pick up for your beloved ones this Christmas. Where do you even start?
That's the thing. Back in the day, this was actually a fairly niche thing, and from time to time you might come across an actual old jersey in a secondhand shop, or you might come across something online on eBay where you could go and purchase it. But the actual market for retro jerseys that might be unbranded or might closely resemble what it was back in the day has just ballooned in the last 5 years. Been huge.
So this is a new piece of clothing that is designed to look like an old piece of clothing.
100%. It's, for instance, if you were to go for what's widely regarded as the best Ireland jersey ever, outside of the Adidas ones, it's the old Chris Hughton pictures, the pinstripes, the O'Neills, the lettering, that kind of stuff. That's the Euro 88 one. Yeah. If you go before that again with the Mark Lawrence era with the pinstripes and all that with O'Neills, O'Neills have managed to cotton on. They did this a while ago because I know I have the jersey version of this from about 10 years ago. And they've decided to make and reissue what were their Ireland gears. So they have the old Shamrock crest, they have the pinstripes going on, and they've got the O'Neills on the right-hand side. The tracksuit has actually proved to be remarkably popular.
Can we stick that back up? So this is the Ireland full-zip retro jacket. This is retailing at €55.
Yeah.
And it is a thing of beauty, isn't it?
It's gorgeous. If anybody is to get one of these for Christmas, they're going to count themselves a lucky sod. I remember seeing somebody with the original one of these when I was working at HMV. Somebody came in wearing one of the 70s ones.
Right.
We had the stitched rep of Ireland on the back of it, and there was about four of us who were all in mad into our football at the time, walked around this person behind them with our jaws on the floor about to go, "Mister, where'd you get that?"
And I presume there's loads of those knocking around that people don't realise have actually, you know, they're sitting on something worth at least 55 quid and probably a bit more.
Probably a little bit more if you wanted to actually trade in your old stuff that you've had around the water for a
while. So where are you getting these?
That's the actual O'Neill's, O'Neill's.com, okay, who have their own modern retakes and remakes of their old classic Ireland gear.
And are people trawling through eBay and car boot sales looking for the actual old ones?
They actually are, yeah. And to be honest with you, most of them, if you find them from back in the day, are ridiculously small. There are a few old Dublin jerseys, I'll say, at home that came from my wife's side of the family, and they were fitting what would have been at the time somebody of about my height and build, but like slimmer. And it's remarkable how
they've shrunk in the wash, Richie.
They have shrunk in the wash.
That's what's happened.
The tracksuits and the jerseys, pretty much years, as 10 years go on, they lose about, I think, 3 inches on either side.
We haven't got bigger.
No, that's not at all.
Unconnected food. Right, so is this a Crystal Palace shirt from the 1990 FA Cup?
I've gone for something slightly more niche here because there is a site called 3retro.com who have amalgamated a lot of the different makers of retro gears, whether it's Scoredraw or whether it's Admiral or whether it's the clubs themselves, and they make them, or Umbro even have their own niche range of stuff as well. This one's a Scoredraw version of what Palace wore on the road to the 1990 FA Cup final. And in fact, the jersey they wore in that cup final, in the first game anyway, at Wembley against Manchester United, which is like the fly version.
It is actually the, right, wow.
It's a remake of it.
I didn't realise the fly version to LA was the sponsorship they had.
The Wright and Bright and Andy Gray days at Crystal Palace, when they had a fantastic side, they got to that cup final. So they've taken a lot of classy jerseys at the time. They're able to finagle ways to get the sponsors onto these things. So on that website alone, not only would you have the likes of Palace, but Liverpool would have a range up there of candy and crown paint stuff. Manchester United would have a range of Sharp stuff up there. Newcastle brown ale stuff, if you wanted to go for a slightly more retro Newcastle jersey as well. Villa jerseys, I'm delighted to say, Ger, are made by Umbro. There are Mita Copiers ones up there. There are versions of the old Hummel and Cox Sportif jerseys that are up there that you're able to get to. So there's loads of, 3 Retro are brilliant in that way. They've loads of different clubs covered. It's not just the big four or five. There's a Derby away jersey, for instance, that I've had my eye on in there for a while. That's brilliant. So you can kind of go through the different clubs, English and overseas, and kind of get stuff there.
It is funny how the pinstripe, when you talked about it, the old Liverpool Crown Paints jersey with the pinstripes, they were class as well.
They are, and that's something, it's a weird one because it's now something that clubs go back to when they're making modern jerseys. They've revisited, like if you look at Liverpool's jersey this season, it's basically a nod to that 1984 Crown Paints European Cup winning jersey season.
Even the Arsenal one this season.
Yeah, and that was 100% intentional from Adidas' point of view, because they got the Adidas Arsenal contract back and they went, how can we plunder this as best we can? We'll make an away gear that references the bruised banana, as it's fondly called. To the degree that Arsenal, just before we spoke here, and actually in the last 4 or 5 days, put out their own official retro kit, which is that bruised banana jersey with the Adidas and the JVC and the crest, as was back then. But it's just a lovely, lovely thing. And brands are kind of able to do that, where they're able to make the best of their arrangements and their prior kind of arrangements with clubs. Adidas did it brilliantly when they got Liverpool's contract back in 2006.
JVC,
Arsenal have done it this time.
Still exists?
Yeah, you can still get the old JVC electronics bits and pieces, yeah.
So they're delighted, obviously.
100%.
Like, pay for it, or is it just like...
I'd imagine there is a nominal kind of, well, we're not going to sell millions of these, but this is your exposure on it, so we'll do a bit of a deal with you. But there are likes of Candy and Crown Paints and Mita Copiers and all that who kind of suddenly have a new bit of shine.
Yeah, okay. To Ireland and to some Irish stuff, what have we got?
Yeah, Scoredraw, as I mentioned, and Coppa in particular have these fantastic range of old school jerseys. Coppa have... They're kind of at the higher price range. If you're looking for stuff like this, they can be in around 50, 60 euro. But of one of the Irish clubs that they latched onto was Cork City, who, I say this as a Bose fan, between the 80s and early 90s, I don't think Cork had a bad jersey, because they had a really unique relationship with Adidas, or the company that was looking after Adidas in this country. So what Coppa did was they took the hooped version of that jersey, green and white hoops with the Guinness sponsorship, which is kind of like what QPR had back in the mid-80s as well, and they released that. And then for those who might be familiar with Cork's travails in the UEFA Cup when they beat Bayern Munich so famously down at Flare Lodge, they have that Dave Barry three stripes across in a sash kind of formation version of that too. So you're able to dip into Cork City's history via Coppa. And again, Coppa are brilliant for continental clubs. They just released Sevilla set. So it's basically different jerseys through the history of Sevilla Football Club, one of which is the Maradona era. They've had Verona, for instance, were marked their 25th anniversary or 20th anniversary, I think it was, of their Serie A triumph was done with a version of that. So you can go through any number of European clubs and Coppa and get their jerseys too.
That Cork City jersey is amazing. If you were in charge of Cork City now, wouldn't you just make that your jersey?
Well, the thing about it is, Cork are kind of hamstrung by the fact they have these team wear contracts with Adidas where they have to go for a certain, you know.
Oh, so you already get the design.
Yeah, they'd have a couple of designs to choose from. Whereas if they actually had a bit more clout with their contracts, they could probably go for a more bespoke leaning upon that. But they have referenced that. There's another version of that Cork releases, a retro kind of jersey with the yellow crest. But yeah, that's all on Cork side as well.
I was walking past Des Kelly's in Phibsborough the other day and they had their ad up saying,
"We're back, baby."
Yeah.
Which is, it's a great thing to have. It's like a local sponsor for a local team. But Des Kelly are back on board with the Bose jersey. And it makes a difference, I think, because a lot of people would have had an uneasy relationship with a betting firm being on a jersey. And it would have had to have been different. The kids' jerseys then have to be different because they can't have a betting firm on it. So they would have Bohemian Foundation on there too. So it brings a uniformity to things and it harkens back to the great days under Roddy, I suppose.
And is the jersey nice now? Is it? Is it good?
The O'Neill stuff, O'Neill's football stuff generally over the past while has actually been really underrated and really, really good. And Bo's has been really lucky in the stuff that they've gotten from him so far. There's an away jersey, I believe, to come over the next while too. I'm not sure if I can give anything away about it, but I have been told what it entails.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very much different to last season's. But yeah, the O'Neill stuff has been really, really good that they've managed to do on a football basis.
Are they going back to the Bob Marley one?
I think lessons have been learned from last year about image rights.
Look, you got to talk to
me and Steve-O. My Steve-O doll might be on the jersey at some stage.
Well, that'd be great. Yeah. I mean,
one sleeve each.
Maybe like those drinks companies who can put your face on a pint. Maybe you could, you know. Get and the last one we have here is, it is a thing of beauty. This is a Wexford.
We don't want to leave the Gaheads in your life out because KC Sports have put out this brilliant range of retro jerseys over the past couple of years. And I think the one we have on screen at the moment is the pick of the bunch. They've an all-school Wexford jersey up there. They've lent on Offaly's history as well. They've lent on Dublin's history as well. So like the pinstripey Dublin ones are available up there too. And they're very faithful recreations, let's say, of kind of glory days jerseys that you would have had back in the day. And it's, you know, if you only have to look at what Wexford have done with their new jerseys, that they very much lent on that history as well and decided to go for a retro look with their modern jersey. But you can go for the old fold-over collar, guaranteed Irish symbol on your breast.
Yeah.
And yellow top and purple bottom on that one. It's brilliant. And KC have a bunch of those and they're all in around €45.
Because we have an old Keepak Meath one in the office here.
Yeah.
Is that yours?
No, that's not mine. I don't think I brought
Tom's.
In my...
I think it's
Tommy's. There's a couple of old school ones. I have the old Matt's copy Meath jersey with a stitched 18 on the back of it as well. It's, again, Meath have kind of lent on there. So it's kind of nice to see history informing the present and stuff like that. But yeah, if you're looking for retro GA jerseys, I think KC's are... And there are others. O'Neill's do them as well, to a degree. And there are other companies too, Ogre too, which can definitely look after you on that front.
Okay, so there's a bunch of different places and we will put up some links to them as well. So O'Neill's, 3 Retro, and the last one there was
Copa,
KCS.
And then KC's, Copa. Yeah.
KC's.
KCS, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff, Richie. That was great. Thanks a million.
Cheers,
sir. A reminder, Best Men's Wear, have the men in your life sorted this Christmas. Gifts from top brands like Hugo Boss, Tommy Hilfiger, Calvin Klein and Marco Capelli, and gifts from as little as €20 all this week here on OTBM. With thanks to Best Men's Wear, we've got prizes every morning to help you in the build-up to Christmas. Anybody who enters the draw this morning, send us your best photo of your favourite retro jersey using the hashtag OTBM, and you're going to be in OTBAM even, and you'll be in for a chance of winning €150 made-to-measure Best Men's Wear shirt.
An education from Richie McCormack there. Anne-Marie Donnelly, you're very welcome to the studio.
Morning, how are things?
You're making the point that the new Wexford jersey is very, very similar to that absolutely amazing retro one.
Yeah, it's fab. Is it a coincidence as Paul Galvin arrives, their jersey game is upped?
No coincidence whatsoever.
Hopefully it doesn't have buttons on it.
Well, yeah. It's true. Well, that would be just completely impractical, Johnny. I don't know why you even suggest that. And of course, you were also making the point off air that once he leaves Kerry, or once he gets a job with another inter-county team at least.
Some sort of rights there.
Yeah,
as Paul Galvin goes to Wexford, Kerry's jersey game goes downhill.
They've really cocked up the Kerry one.
Yeah, it's not nice. Let's just call it a spade a spade. But why take, like, if something's right, don't mess with it.
See, this is what's creeping into the GEA now, is that they need a new jersey every year, or at least every second year in this case. And that's to take an amazing design and just get rid of it. Now, granted, they would have needed to come up with a new design at some point anyway, and there was no way they were going to improve the 2018 jersey, so I don't know. I'm just disappointed. I'm not even angry with Kerry at this point.
I'm just disappointed. I'm not angry with you. I'm disappointed.
Mm-hmm. They're basically going to wear a Donegal jersey next season.
If they win an All-Ireland in it, though, you...
I'm totally fine with that. But like, it would have been way better to win the All-Ireland in that one.
Some nice jerseys there all the same from Richie.
Oh, amazing. Mm.
Some good memories. Cork City ones are very, very nice. That Wexford one at the end was an absolute beaut. Mm. I think we were sent in the Galway United 1991 Cup Final jersey on Twitter as well, which we might get time to show, which had the Wrangler on the front. Pretty cool, yeah. Geez, that's going back 28 years now.
The thing is with modern sports jerseys, well, I'm judging this basically on Premier League, is that it's very, very hard to tell who's sponsoring who. Because I guess it's all foreign betting companies that we don't actually see on a day-to-day basis here, that if it was maybe companies that we're more familiar with.
No great affiliation with the sponsor, yeah.
Yeah, and all their logos are shite. Like, all those companies, their logos are just... Yeah. I suppose that they're in, alphabets that we don't understand and stuff sometimes. Yeah. I don't know, they're terrible, to be quite honest with you.
United used to have digital as well, which was... Jerry Gray, who was the old chairman, he was involved with digital, and that was the iconic kind of one on the jersey for years. And as Richie was saying there, the Des Kelly one for Bowes is great because Des Kelly is a proper local supporter of Bowes, and there were issues with having a gambling sponsor on the shirt because you can't have a gambling sponsor when you're under 13 jersey, so they couldn't have uniformity. But Des Kelly is a proper local supporter and part of what Bowes are doing, so, and it's a beautiful jersey as well.
Anne-Marie,
Rick logoless jersey last year was the most sold O'Neill's jersey.
Was it?
I remember it had no sponsor. Yeah, well, I know obviously sales would go up when you win an All-Ireland, but yeah, it had no sponsor. Remember?
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it looked weird without the Sporting Liberty, to be quite honest.
I didn't think it was.
I didn't think it was. Well, to be fair,
I really liked it without it.
You're getting into an argument with a serious fashionista here. He knows everything about jersey. I just did not think that jersey was nice whatsoever without the logo. It just looked unusual and weird. And the classic jerseys without the logo is ever nice. The Meath jersey that they mentioned.
Change is good, though.
Change is good. Don't get me wrong. It's great. And I like the idea of a plain jersey. But I just thought that one, it looked unfinished. I'm very surprised by that.
Well, it's been very annoying with the Ireland jerseys that you have to have the logo on the jersey because the Irish team don't wear it. So why do we have to wear it?
You see, I would tell you, I would say that the on-field one looks nice because they've got a number in the middle rather than just a plain green.
What's wrong with plain?
As I say, for the Limerick one, I just thought it just looked kind of boring, to be totally honest.
Understated.
I'm
with Anne-Marie on this one.
Yeah.
You are starting with Paul Galvin this morning, Anne-Marie.
Paul Galvin, obviously, leading the headlines this morning. The Wexford senior football manager is facing a backlash. I know you speak about this briefly earlier on. Some of his players, according to reports, are dropping out. The four-time All-Ireland winner has dropped Doughy Waters and last year's captain, Michael Furlong, from his panel. And then it's believed that Kevin O'Grady and Tiernan Rossiter have themselves left the squad. That's in a show of solidarity with the players that have been dropped. Matty Ford then has allegedly departed from the backroom team. So we'll see how that one pans out. Everton, meanwhile, look to be making progress in finding a successor to Marco Silva. As the club's new manager, officials have confirmed they've met with a number of candidates. They say no contract offer has been made just yet, but reports suggest that former Chelsea boss Carlo Ancelotti has agreed a deal and will take over at Goodison Park this week. Meanwhile then, a Wilfried Zaha wonder strike last night extended Palace's unbeaten run to four games. They missed out on the chance though to go level on points with United as they had to come away from Brighton with a 1-1 draw, and that moves them up to ninth in the table. With the first team away on Club World Cup duty in Qatar, it'll be a youthful Liverpool side thrust into Carabao Cup quarter-final action tonight. Under 23 manager Neil Critchley takes charge of the side as they're away to Aston Villa, and he's spoken about how proud he'll be to be on the line for that game.
I hope we go and play how I know they are capable of playing. There's no better feeling for a coach when the players who are representing you and you've got a relationship with go and play to their capabilities. And if they do that, then that's where my pride will come from.
Did you hear his press conference?
No, it's a rare occasion where a manager can actually talk about getting the call up briefly.
Yeah. But,
Critchley's clearly got that opportunity. Caoimhín Kelleher, another man who'll get
that
opportunity.
Yeah, Caoimhín Kelleher is set to start. He hasn't gone to Qatar and kickoff there is at 7:45. Finally then, a mixed night for the Irish, who were in action at the PDC World Darts Championship last night. 17-year-old Keane Barry, the fairy tale, unfortunately didn't come through. He was whitewashed 3-0 by Vincent van der Voort at Alexander Palace. Carlos Steve Lennon then lost in a thriller 3-2 to Englishman Callan Ridds. Limerick's Willie O'Connor, though, is through to round two. He had a straight sets win over Finland's Marco Cantele.
Good stuff, Anne-Marie. Thanks a million for that. Right, we do plenty of book interviews on the show. My favourite one is one we've got coming up. It's with Brendan Moran of Sportsfile. Enjoy this.
Okay, Sportsfile have got a brand new edition of A Season of Sundays out. It's their annual collection of the best of their Gaelic Games photography throughout the preceding 12 months. And I'm delighted to say that Sportsfile's Brendan Moran is with us in studio. Brendan, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Sean.
How are you keeping?
Very good now.
If you want to start off with a general enough one here, there are some incredible GA moments captured in this. If you had to pick your favourite GA moment, as a Kerry man, perhaps park your bias for a second here. But what was your favourite GA moment captured throughout the year?
It's a strange one, really. Like, as you say, the whole Dublin thing, we'll kind of brush over that now, right? Because they won't necessarily like us for that. But there's a lot of moments in the GA season that can be pretty good. You know, we do everything from the lowest, you know, McGrath Cup or O'Born Cup, we start at that level and we go all the way to the All-Ireland Final. In terms of favourite moments, sometimes they can be the easiest thing, like we'd have a lad buying out of the chip van in Ossensack Park in December, you know, bad weather, you know, a game that's quite low profile.
We have that fella up there up on the screen. This was Limerick against Kerry in the Munster Hurling League or
sometimes we'd be looking, like a lot of time we'd be looking out for that type of thing, because, you know, there's an abundance of photography now in our place this year, and it's just trying to find the space for them. Like, while we deal with online companies and we deal with web newspapers and websites and everything else, like, we just sometimes, we've gone this over 20 years now, and it's just nice to have something to have our own little outlet for pictures that we like and not necessarily what everybody else likes. In terms of my own favourite, like I love the emotion in sport nowadays and the excitement. And like, I took a picture of a Wexford fan this year, and like Wexford and Tipperary in, was it the All-Ireland semi-final or quarter-final?
All-Ireland semi-final, there's the photo there.
Yeah, like Wexford had were winning the game comfortably and Tip just came back. And sometimes I'd be looking, that wouldn't necessarily make the sports pages, but it might make the front page of the newspaper. So yeah, you'd always look out for you'd be keeping your eye as the game goes on in the crowd and see you'd look for somebody that's shouting and roaring, because they're the people that are very emotive. And your man just try to creep behind his shirt, and it was just an interesting scene, though, I have to say.
Do you remember what time of the match that was at? Probably during the night.
It would have been late in the second half. It would have been late in the second half, because I would have been in the canal end. And I had Wexford coming into me in the first half, and like, they scored a couple of goals and things were looking rosy for them, in fairness. But then when the tide started turning and Tipperary coming at me in the second half, so I have to watch Tipperary, but I'm also trying to look out for the likes of this. So I kind of can't take my eye off the pitch, but then again, depending on where the ball is on play, I might swing around, look for somebody, swing back, over back. So it's, sometimes you're a little bit like an assassin, that you're kind of trying to pick out a moment. You know, you're just trying to pick out a moment, but you can't take your eye off the game.
It's just got an image. What's the name of that World War II documentary I can't remember it. Featuring the snipers anyway. I just have a picture of you up in a tower in Moscow somewhere with a sniper. Like, you're down on the side of the pitch there. It's like, anybody who talks about journalists, they say they have the best seat in the house or whatever. I would argue photographers have the very, very best seat in the house. I mean, you get to, I presume, actually hear what's going on, and there's kind of a sense that nobody who's paying good money to be in the stands actually gets when you're down there right in the heat of it.
Oh, yeah, you do hear, well, again, you wouldn't necessarily hear what players are talking about on the pitch, but you do get a sense of the speed of the game, particularly when you're low down. Like, I would argue, if I was a fan watching the game, I'd rather be up high, because you can see play develop easier than if you're on pitch side, because it's very hard to determine distances. But when you're close up to it, like, the speed of the game, even the way they talk about, like, certainly in hurling, the way they talk about two referees and things like that, like, certainly at the quarterfinal, semi-final, All-Ireland final level of hurling, I don't know how they haven't got two referees in, because, like, the ball is pucked 60, 70, 80 yards, and there's a referee trying to see what's going on in real time while he's running or while he's moving. that's a very difficult job. So you do get a far greater sense of the speed of the game when you're right in front of it and you're close to it. And sometimes you get hits and sometimes, you know, injuries and things like that happen. And you can get a far greater sense straight away of what's going on or the reaction to, by a player, which you wouldn't get on TV because they don't have microphones, or you wouldn't get in the stand. So yeah, we're a lucky bunch of people, all right.
There was another image of that Wexford fan on screen there. He got good coverage that day of on the All-Ireland semi-final. When you say you get hits and stuff like that, I presume you haven't had any near misses yourself or anything like that when you're that close?
You do get clobbered. Like I do a lot of basketball, and being under the net sometimes can be quite dangerous. But you just have to be aware of your surroundings. There is times that players would come close to you. You just got to be real careful in that some of the grounds you sit behind the ads, other grounds you're sitting kind of in the corner. Now, we'd sit out in the corner for various number of reasons, but you're as far away as the play is going to... Like, it's rare a player goes out to the corner, certainly in Gaelic games. But you just do have to be careful because sometimes grounds are tight and there's a runoff area. And there's nothing worse than a player comes close to you and he's celebrating in front of you and you've got the wrong lens. Mm. Because... Like, we would have long lenses and kind of medium lenses then for, like, goal mouth and try area. But if a fella's standing right in front of you, the worst thing that can happen to you is you're looking at him, everybody sees you on the television, and then they're wondering, how is he didn't get the picture? So there's nothing worse than, like, fumbling around. And so you have to be aware that you make sure that you're in the right position and that you don't get caught out.
Yeah.
Particularly if you don't get caught out in television, because everybody sees then, you know. Even your photographer mates are going, he definitely doesn't have that picture, because we know by looking at the camera that he has, or the lens that he has. So it's, yeah, you try and avoid, you know, we're not there to be part of the event. We're only there to record the event. So you try and stay out of their way as much as you can.
It's pre-season time at the moment and peak club action at the moment as well, which for me, like when I'm watching it on television, there's just something so pure about TG Cahir is set up in a place and the weather is terrible and they have to like start wiping the lens and all that to actually produce a good picture for the people at home. Similarly for yourself, it just leads to extraordinary photography, whether it's waterlogged pitches that we've never seen the likes of before, but particularly whenever the snow hits once in a while. And you were down in, it was Killarney actually, for the Blizzard, the Meath-Kerry Hurling League game. I went to the football afterwards. I didn't brave these elements. We can see this on screen. This is one of the best images in Sportsfile this year. You took it. Like, that just must add a whole new layer of challenge to your art when those sort of conditions are coming down.
Well, it's exciting in a way, which sounds a bit perverse in some ways. Like, while we see bad weather and we see heavy rain and all that, it can make for great photography. Now, you end up getting soaked, but that's just the way it is. Like, that day in particular, there was two games. Kerry played Monaghan in the football afterwards. And surprisingly enough, the snow came down. And, like, for the football, there was no snow on the pitch at all.
Yeah.
So it was a bit freakish, but I knew, like, while the Kerry... It was Kerry Meath, wasn't it? Yeah. Kerry Meath wasn't going to be huge high profile. I knew that there was a picture in it somewhere. Like... There was pictures everywhere that day. Like, we've picture in the season Sundays. There's some other pictures out of it. And at one stage, the lad has taken a sideline cut and he's kind of going, oh, yeah, look, you know, stand back or whatever. But they react. He thought it was somebody else, I think. But there's definitely, you know that there's a picture in it and you know you've only a short window to get it. So I only photographed the first half of that game. Because kind of the second half, the snow kind of stopped and I was like, ah, sure, look, there's no picture in it. No. The pictures... You have to grab the opportunity when you get a chance. And that snow was just like... and it's funny, Kerry would rarely get snow compared to the rest of the country. Like, I've been in Monaghan one time, and actually it was Kerry and Monaghan, and the match got called off. By the time I left the ground, after I'd sent a few pictures, there was no snow. So it's funny the way January, February, March goes with weather. It can be totally extreme. You can be... blanket in the snow and the ref comes up and calls the match off because it's too dangerous and all the Kerry fans have to go home. But then 2 hours later, like, it's blazing sunshine and there's nothing on the pitch. But, you know, is it exciting? Now, you could be drying out for days afterwards, like the Ireland hockey qualifier there recently in November. I've never seen rain like that on the Saturday night. Like, absolutely soaking. And no matter what you did, you couldn't keep dry. But there's still an excitement in you going, there's going to be a picture in this, and you're waiting, and you're working through it. Sometimes there isn't, but you kind of do hope that there could be a spectacular picture because the conditions are all coming together, and all you need is a specific, small moment to make it all worthwhile. You know, and if you get wet, you get wet.
Absolutely. Jack Regan was the name of the Meath hurler who told you to feck off for a moment there.
I think he thought I was somebody else because I was talking to the guy that was giving him the towel afterwards, and he says, oh, he thought you were somebody else.
But actually, you're perfectly placed. Breaking news today, a yellow slitter coming into hurling. This is obviously, when you pick up the back page of the newspaper today, you're obviously throwing it up in the air in celebration that for days like this.
But, oh, yeah, because like part of the, one of the pictures I had on our pictures of the year kind of was, I think, Jack trying to take a sideline cut. You look at all the snow, like, where's the slitter?
The ball, yeah.
You know, if you'd yellow there, it would be easier. It wouldn't have been as good a picture for me, but it would have been a lot easier for him. Do you know what I mean? And you do see it in, certainly, floodlit games during the league. I would suspect, I'm surprised they haven't brought it in sooner.
Yeah.
Because lads looking up into lights like that, and there's a ball flying at them at, whatever, 60, 70 miles, like, trying to catch that in your hand.
It's impossible.
Like, there's the one thing I love about covering hurling is that their hand-eye coordination is fantastic. It's unbelievable, you know, top-class hurling.
Yeah, and eye-hand coordination, important for a photographer as well. So there's obviously kind of a mutual respect there between the
Yeah, well, we don't have a chance of a replay.
Here we've got a brilliant photo. This is another one from the All-Ireland hurling final. We will mention it briefly, Brendan. We may as well talk about Dublin's five in a row as well, because there's some beautiful shots. In fairness, beautiful shots throughout the book of that historic day, whether it's the Dublin fans, whether it's the Dublin players, and just the scene, the joyous scenes, I guess, in both codes, in the women's football and in the men's football. It's brilliant stuff. Just like some cracking photos there of Stephen Cluxton and the balloons around him. And like, I guess when you're on the ground at that moment, there are so many things happening.
Oh, yeah, but like we would, our day for an All-Ireland final, everything from like 10 o'clock in the morning is laid out like in a timeline. So we know, because we would do a lot of corporate work and a lot of sponsor work as well on the day. So we would have whatever many 8 or 9 photographers at the game, and everything is planned out to the minute. So everybody, while there's a lot goes on, for us, if we don't plan it, people are going to be bumping into each other. And so everybody gets their own little task. Some people shoot with wide angle lenses, some people shoot with long lenses. And we're trying to tell a story today. And one thing we are is a library as well, so we're there for the history of the event. So it's not just about getting pictures online or getting pictures in the newspaper or whatever. We're also there to record a history, and the likes of the Season Sundays is there for a historical record. Like, we've done it for 20 odd years, and even the way Ireland has changed, kit has changed, people's look has changed, style has changed, lots have changed over that time. And it's like the All-Ireland final days now are so big that we could put in 20 more pictures in the book, but we just don't have the space. Mm. And so trying to edit it down, editing now becomes a key component of what we do as much as taking the pictures, because there's so many good pictures out there and you just can't put everything into it. Mm. And all our finals, there's always a great, like particularly Limerick last year, you know, Tipperary this year. Okay, the Dubs won 5 in a row this year, and that's truly historic. But when a team win for the first time in a long time, it's the emotion out of the players is amazing, and that's gold for a photographer. Like, you just can't wait. So the day Mayo win eventually, if and when it happens, that'll be just unbelievable.
A photographer's dream.
Oh, absolutely.
We want to talk about some of your moments of the decade before we let you go, Brendan, because we may as well start with Mayo, because they've given you quite a few moments this decade, and like capturing emotion is obviously one of the most important things as a photographer. It's something that a video can't really achieve sometimes. It actually is the still that kind of just sums it all up. This year it's like a Renaissance painting almost.
Well, it's funny you say that, because the designer of our book, Patter Staunton, said that to me one time when he saw that picture. He was just like, there's so much going on in it. If you look at all, like, essentially that was just a snap in that I wasn't really concentrating on it. I just saw them lined up, because my job that day was to take the losing team, not take the winning team.
Okay.
So you have to
split it up.
Yeah, everybody can't go after the winner. Somebody has to take the losers as well, or the runners up, or whatever.
I presume if you're covering the losing team more often, you more often get better stuff.
Well, you can do, but you're, again, it's a bit like the analogy I meant earlier about the assassin. You're looking around for a moment. Now, lots is happening. So you have wide lenses and long lenses and this, that and the other. So you're shooting fellas tight that there might be, you know, you'd kind of watch the reaction between players. But the likes of this, it's got the whole sense of Dublin fans celebrating, the streamers are still hanging around there, but the Mayo team are just standing there. And like, the All-Ireland was there for the taking that year. They could have been champions. They could have been...
This is 17. You know,
I think so, yeah. Like, there would have been another picture I had from a previous year where the fireworks had gone off. There was a bit of sun streaming through the roof of Croke Park. Rob Henley is walking off.
There we are.
Yeah, like...
That's class.
That's one of the greatest pictures I ever took. And it's just the split second that you kind of look for this. You're looking around for something and you're going, what's here? And you're mooching around and there might be nothing, but you have to keep your eyes open. And sometimes it just all comes together. And like, that would be a better picture for me than going taking some lad lifting the Sam Maguire. Mm. It's historic and all, but it's not as good a picture as something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll quickly get the Alan Brogan photo up as well, because I think like that's you took that as well. That is obviously after the 2014 game.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Like, and then like I think for me there's two iconic images of tears from the last decade. There's that one, and then there's obviously the Derek McGrath on Dan Shanahan's shoulder, and they're the kind of ones that you kind of remember of pure emotion. But also as well, when it comes back to you and the photos you've taken throughout this decade, there's two Olympic Games we need to talk about. Because, First of all, we start with London 2012 and having this almost certified moment that you would have a gold medal shoot happening in front of you. Now, it wasn't a total guarantee, but going into that Games, you were like, I could have a camera in my hand and it is up to me to capture Ireland winning their first gold medal in whatever it was, 16 years in this Olympic
Game. Like, again, there would have been, there was three of us there that year, Steve McCarthy, Dave Marr, and myself. So that, like, that day when Katie's in the Olympic final, you're going, there's nothing else matters. Mm. Like, doesn't matter who else is running, doesn't matter, like Usain Bolt could be one of the 100 metres, don't care, nothing to do with us, right? So we put all our resources into that, and we somewhat planned it. Like, you don't plan the fight because you don't know which way she's going to turn or where her dad's going to be or whatever, because he was in a ring that time. And but for the ceremony, it was kind of, I said, look, I'm not going to be ringside. I'm not going to be, I have to look for something that's not obvious. And in fairness, I tried to take like the score, you know, the whole context of it, the arena full of Irish people, you know, there's flags there, there's fans cheering. It's during the national anthem, admittedly, so they've all stood still. But you've got the scoreboard, you've got the Irish flag, you know, Katie standing there. Like, it's an easy picture taken necessarily of her sitting there or standing there with her medal. But to get something that's a bit more generic, and I would think it possibly stands... Like, it's a historic picture. It's not necessarily a picture for a newspaper, but it's a historic picture because you look at the picture and you know, okay, she beat who she beat. Like, it has the names of the other boxers. It has the Irish tricolour. It has them standing for the anthem. It shows the arena. It shows there's lots of Irish fans there. So it's in one picture, it encapsulates quite a lot.
In your view, like, is boxing up there as an enjoyable sport to cover? Because you associate boxing with iconic photography. Like, obviously, it's the one from Rome, 1960, of Muhammad Ali.
It's very difficult. It's a bit like hurling, right? Hurling obviously wouldn't be on a global scale, but there's a split second, you know, and it's very rare two photographers will get the same picture in any event. And particularly boxing is nearly, you need to be ahead of time. So you nearly need to be like the opponent. You need to be in that, because if you shoot when a fella throws a punch, you've probably missed the punch when he hits a face.
Sure.
So you have to anticipate it quite a lot. And while even though the cameras can shoot real fast now, you can still miss it because they're just like, punches are just a blink of an eye. So boxing and hurling, in my opinion, would be by far the hardest sports to cover.
And we just had an image up there a moment ago, which is just class. This one, if you missed that by a second, you would have missed it entirely. That's incredible.
There would have been a thing in sport about no ball, no picture.
Yeah.
There's no ball in that. And that wouldn't have been the first picture I sent on the day. It would have been the second. But the fact that the hurley splits in two and you see the splinters, like there'd be another picture that I would have sent you on where Seamus Canlan ran into a Limerick goalkeeper and he actually broke his teeth. And his teeth are in the picture.
Jesus.
And I didn't realise it at the time. I just thought it was like saliva or something. But then Seamus went off and he had blood and he came back on and I just didn't think anything of it. It was only afterwards I heard he'd lost teeth. But you can actually see the splinters of teeth in the photograph. And they're clear enough, but it's quite small in the picture. But you'd never see that on a television.
Yeah, we're just about to get it up on screen here now. I don't actually know if I'm familiar with this.
I probably should have tipped you off, you know, and said it because... I said, I didn't even notice when I saw the picture in the first place, but it was only going back in the car and I'm going, oh, yeah, he had stitches in his mouth, all right. And then I looked at the picture a bit closer and I thought about it. And so...
Oh, like, my God.
Yeah, like you can just see his face guard there come up against him. And they're actually his teeth.
Jesus. How many teeth are we talking here?
I couldn't tell you that. Like, I've spoken to Seamus about it afterwards, and he's like, he thinks it's grass. You know what I mean? But like,
I've never seen that photograph before. It's probably the most famous photo out there now. And
sometimes it's hard to see the wood from the trees, but it sometimes you do capture things that you go, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, the man's teeth.
No ball, no photo. Is that your phrase?
Well, because we'll make an exception the odd time.
We'll make an exception for this last one as well. Possibly the most iconic sports photo of the decade. It's apt because it was part of our memorable sports moment of the decade. This is you. This is your photo, Pat Hickey. When you say you're kind of like an assassin, are you lying in a knoll or a
like that,
bunker?
That would have been, like, we were out covering the Olympics and it was kind of there was a lull day before it, kind of, there wasn't that much Irish going on. And I got a text at like 7:30 in the morning, Rio, going, Pat Hickey has been arrested. And I'm going, ugh, this is kind of now going to, it turns into news. Mm. And the fact that he was a member of the IOC executive, it like was big international news. So I got the text, met my colleagues, Ramsey and Stephen, and we kind of go, okay, what are we going to do? Ramsey went to the police station. I went to the hospital. Stephen continued to cover the Irish that day because we didn't really know how serious it was going to be. And I sat there with a number of other media at the hospital for like 12 or 16 hours. Nothing happened. We had to go back the next morning because we didn't know what was going to go on. And the following day, the day this picture was taken, Thomas Barr was in his 400-meter final. And he ended up being fourth. So we had to cover that. Mm. So Stephen took on the shift at the hospital. And we went to, myself and Ramsey covered Tom Barr and he came fourth and that was fine and everything was. But then we got a text from Stephen saying, look, we think he's going to be released within an hour. So we all barreled down. And, like, there would have been a plan where you'd try and photograph through the window, like Morris Court. You know, when people are coming out of court, you try and photograph in the window with a flash, and that's kind of your picture of the person in the car. But I stood at the top of the ramp, because we saw where the cop cars were going down, and I stood at the top of the ramp, and it's very hard to see down, like, as you can see, it's quite silhouetted there, but there was a lot of backlight coming in from. So it's a hard picture. It was a picture, but we didn't think it would be the picture. Mm. But when the car came up the ramp, like as soon as the wheelchair came out, I knew the profile of Pat. So I just started shooting straight away, like just nailed it as quick as I could. He got into the car. I alerted everybody else. There's TV from all over the world there, other photographers from Reuters and AP and everybody else. So once the car started coming up then, I couldn't even see in the windscreen, which is very unusual. Like you normally could see in the windscreen, I was going to tip them off which seat he'd be in, which side of the car he'd be in. Couldn't see anything. So then it came into me going, okay, there's going to be a problem here in that we may not see him at all. Mm. So we actually didn't see him. Do you know what I mean? The car came up.
That was all he had.
And all the lads that photographed in the windows, sure, all they did was get reflections of each other in it because you just couldn't see it through the tinted windows. So this was like the best picture of the day. Do you know what I mean? Because there was no sighting of Pat. Now, the following day, I think maybe a local AFP photographer went and tried to find out where he was staying and all that. And there may have been pictures in the subsequent days, but on the day it happened, like this was the only picture that you could recognise Pat in.
Yeah, it's class, absolutely class. Thanks just a couple of more to run through before we wrap up. Some other memorable moments of the day. Shane Lowry and the likes are going to feature here, I'd imagine. There's Kieran Kingston and The Rock. There's Gucci Pat O'Shea. Great moment.
Oh, yeah.
St. Patrick's Day.
One of his greatest days, probably.
This one wasn't taken on a camera.
No, like this was taken on an iPhone. And while doing the Olympics, like people think big events are glamorous and all that, but it's an awful lot of time waiting and you're on a bus and you have to go here and then you have to wait for another bus and then you're going there. So the amount of time you spend at Olympics or World Cups or whatever photographing is very small. And as you know yourself from Japan recently, like there's a lot of time spent waiting around. So I kind of took it on myself that to kind of keep me sane, I put up a picture on my Facebook, one picture every day that I took with my phone. And like this would have been a Japanese writer, so I didn't need to take a Japanese writer, but you use the filters on the phone with the various apps and all that. And it's just something I did a little project on just for myself and for just to get a nice little picture for myself, not for Sportsfiler, not for anything else. And I kind of proved to a point that you can get some nice pictures with anything, even a camera phone, if you know what you're doing and, you know, you're looking out for the right things. So it's not always about the equipment.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just about being able to take nice pictures. And like the amount of iPhone photography out there or smartphone photography out there, that's the cameras are really good now. And you know, anybody can do it.
100%. I'm not sure if anybody can do it, but they're certainly getting a lot better. Shane Lowry here this week, or this year, I should say, winning the Open. That's just...
That was an amazing... Like, I didn't even notice there in the Shane Lowry one that Wendy, the wife, has her hand up to her face and she's kind of in shock. You know, sometimes you just record the moment and then you see things in Africa. It's like the Simon Zeebo picture there was that...
Yeah, so this is, I presume, the Glasgow game after...
Yeah, it was. And while... there was the thing about Axel 8 in the stand and we'd planned for that and my colleague Dermot took that and all that. I was just kind of going across the people and it was only a slight little thing and it was actually my boss Ray that spotted it and he was the one that made the decision in the office going, look, crop in there and convert it to black and white and because you can just see the tear far. Like, I don't recall seeing the tear necessarily, but because I would have been gone through all the players just to see if anybody reacted. You take a couple of frames, and then... It was only when I sent it afterwards that the office saw and it got huge reaction to. Like, I would have photographed Anthony Foley playing, and he was such a nice man, and he was just a huge loss to them.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it says a lot there. There's more Chicago there. We've got Joe Schmidt and Devin Toner. There's Sonia there, Budapest 98, there's Rory Best. Presumably, that is Japan just gone.
Yeah, we're there to record history, so...
Absolutely. Well, congratulations on a brilliant year, a brilliant decade. It's a season of Sundays. Images of the 2019 Gaelic Games year by the Sportsfile photographers. It's a brilliant Christmas present for anybody looking for something at the moment. It's out now. Final point to note before we wrap up. Enemy at the Gates is the name of that sniper movie. Go watch it because it's basically you. You're the star of that. Ireland's greatest assassin, Brendan Moran. Thanks a million.
Thanks very much, John. Cheers.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
The most memorable Irish sporting moment of the decade.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
My dream's been shattered now. Amateur boxing stinks from the core right to the top.
Oh, Robbie Brady, you hero! We thought we'd missed our chance. What a moment! What a goal! We're heading to the knockout stages and don't Ireland deserve it?
Olympic champion, I've dreamed of this moment so many times before.
It's spinning! It's spinning! Jonathan Sexton has made it! He has snatched victory from the jaws of defeat for Ireland!
The most memorable Irish sporting moment of the decade.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
From true crime believers to science and business achievers, sports, arts and comedy to the latest entertainment wannabe. Get political, get healthy, get educated. Get all your favourite podcasts on Go Loud. Download the Go Loud app now or add us on your smart speaker. Go Loud, podcasts, radio and music to your ears.
OTB AM.
You're very welcome back. If you're just joining us, that was Brendan Moran of Sportsfile chatting about A Season of Sundays. And that book is out now. The YouTube video of that full chat is up now as well. We are turning our attention, though, to the moment of the decade, Ireland's most memorable sporting moment of the decade. We are into the last four. We are into the semi-final stage. And today, Johnny, we've got an absolute cracker. It is Shane Long versus Shane Lowry. The poll is live. Two heavy hitters. We expected the two Shanes to make it to the semi-final stage. They've duly delivered on that promise and roared into the last four. Who have you got?
Yeah. Football is our biggest sport. But at the same time, beating Germany at home, as great as it is, it doesn't compare to Lowry winning the Open. But I would go with Shane Long because we beat Germany at home. It was... we don't beat good teams at all anymore. The only win against a good team I can remember was the French game in Paris, which ultimately ended in defeat, but we did beat them over 90 minutes. Apart from that, in many years, I can't remember a good team we've actually beaten in a competitive game, and that Germany game was the outlier. We've gotten some good results, like beat Austria away under Martin O'Neill, got some good...
Wales.
Yeah, but that was horrible. The Germany performance was a little bit backs the wall, as you'd expect. We're playing against a far better resource team, but the nature of the goal, you know, it was a brilliant strike by Shane Long. The place was apoplectic, and golf is golf at the end of the day. You know, golf is not the people's game. Football is.
But Shane Lowry is the people's person.
Shane Lowry's an absolute champ. You know, that's the only thing.
That's different.
Yeah, Shane Lowry is definitely the people's person. I don't know how the voting's going to go on this, because I really have little or no interest in golf. So, but I suppose on social media, whenever there is like a major, one of the Masters is on or whatever, you know, there seems to be enormous interest in it. I don't know golf. I'm extremely bad at golf. I tried it once. It was shockingly bad. And so football is kind of my main sport, and I'm going to go with Shane Long. Also, because we've had so little to cheer. The Ireland Italy game to me is complete bullshit. That Italy weren't even. Italy had a half a team out that day. Couldn't give a damn.
We qualified from our group.
We did, but like we qualified for the last 16 in the Euros. Like big deal. Bloody hell. I mean, it's we should be. That shouldn't be like something to be really really celebrating. Considering Italy like did not give a damn that night.
We didn't get to the last 16 of the Euros since 1988.
We didn't back in the days when it was.
Oh, sorry, that was 18s, in the last eight, really.
18s, yeah.
We never got to 16 team Euros.
Yeah, and we're struggling in this one as well to get there. But I think we've been used to being pretty poor in Ireland in terms of football. But that win was an exceptional achievement, to be fair, to beat Germany. It was a great goal. It wasn't one of these scruffy goals. It was a long ball. It was an unbelievable finish. Well, I don't know how it's going to go, though. How do you think it'll go?
I think Shane Lowry wins this. Mm. I think Shane Lowry is a better sport at the moment. I think Katie Taylor is going to beat him in the final. I think that was... And we'll edge it in the final. But I can't be confident in that. As I say, this is a vote for a moment. This is about how you feel. And I think there are two very different emotions when you compare these two moments. One is pure ecstasy that Ireland had just beaten Germany and that goal is insane. And there's an instant hit to it. Whereas with Shane Lowry, there was the entirety of the Saturday, which is a very serene, pleasurable experience and kind of thrilling as well to a certain point. And then just the joy of the Sunday.
I'm not sure serene, pleasurable experience has ever been used in three words together before. Serene, pleasurable. Bit of an oxymoron going on there.
Not at all, actually. Actually.
One can derive pleasure out of serenity.
Yes, 100%. 100%.
I'd like a vote on that.
And like that Saturday performance was absolutely unbelievable. And then Sunday he actually does it, but it's the moment that carries over with it is the celebrations afterwards, the homecoming,
going which to the was, boar's head, and
exactly, it was quite unique, and his grandmother being quite
grandmother,
a character.
That was fantastic. Yeah, Shane Lowry's like, I don't know if there's a more likable sportsman in Ireland, but it's golf, I suppose.
Yeah,
the refuge of the few. Like, even though we're very good at it in this island, we're one of the three sports I would say we're maybe world leaders at or thereabouts.
And did he not become a golf nut for that one weekend when it was becoming apparent, maybe midway through his third
all,
round?
Do you think you're an outlier? Don't think I watched any of it.
Right,
but that's not probably usually though. I don't know, was I racing? I just don't have interest in golf really. So
fair enough. You're always going to go for Shane Long in this then.
Although like in 10 years, I suppose we should be recording one notable victory in football, like, which, and this one was it. Like, look at Northern Ireland.
I know there was two. In fairness, there was two. Like, you have to say the Italy win.
I don't buy into that at all.
It was notable.
It was notable, but it wasn't something that we should be still talking about. Like, it was, move on. Like, we've been crap for a long time now.
Well, we've been crap since Shane Long's goal as well. And we're talking about this and you're still basking in it.
Yeah, we're talking about, but like we've been crap
for longer after Long's goal, and we've been crap for longer after Robbie Brady's goal.
We celebrated 1990, where we played horrendous football and didn't win a game in the whole World Cup, and basically tried to bore our way to the. You know, granted, we were punching a bit above our weight, but we have to have higher expectations of our team. Like, watch the under-15s against England in that friendly yesterday, like playing unbelievable football, the passing they were doing, and then compared to our own like national team, which has been basically shite to watch since I've been born, or at least most of it. So I think we have to have a changed discourse about the international team. We should be better than this. We should be better than celebrating one good win in 10 years, really. One proper good win.
Well, we can still celebrate the moment and what it was, and that's what we're doing.
Still giving it ahead of Lowry, actually. But
it's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, I just think soccer is the main sport in this country. It was a good point made in that article in Independent today. The guy who was on about the sponsor.
Declan Lee
was on about, like, there were still more people watched England and Croatia than watched the All-Ireland Hurling and Football Final in the same year. So it was an interesting point.
It is, yeah. Like, actually, I didn't realise that, to be honest with you. I know those figures are always made public. I actually hadn't realised that.
We have a fascination with the English football team as well, which is another thing. But I don't know. I think it was a great moment. To be fair, to beat Germany at home was a great moment.
We've got a competition winner today. The best retro jersey sent in was Conor McKeown from Mayo. I'm sure we can get the image up on screen. When is that from? What era?
That looks like something that would come out now as a kind of a fake retro jersey. It's that good. Like, that's a proper beautiful jersey.
Well, Kieran in my ear is that it's saying Chris Hughton definitely wore it, which is certainly the case.
They changed the logo, obviously. They have three shamrocks there. Then they changed it again. I think they might have to change it again, will they?
Yeah, probably would have to, yeah. But what would you go for in the new logo?
Oh, God. Don't know. I mean, you can't just throw that at me at 9:22 in the morning. What would you go for in the new logo? I need to put a bit of thought into this. Logos, people pay millions to change a logo of a business. You can't just foist that on me. What would you put in it, though? Like a football?
Football. You're not liking a shamrock.
I like that. That logo was gone, though, then. When the FBI had a new logo, hadn't it? It changed, and now it has a new one again. It's kind of... That was like the IRFU logo, more or less, wasn't it? Like the three shamrocks.
Yeah, it actually is quite similar.
Yeah, in honour of St. Patrick.
The current one is kind of like a football cum shamrock. It's kind of like a combination of two, and it's a bit
unfortunately
different.
It's linked with a pretty bad regime, so I think they won't hang around with it too long.
New logo, new actual name for the company. There's been some great suggestions this morning. We're going to continue that competition throughout the morning. I should mention as well that if you want to vote for the moment of the decade or Ireland's most memorable sporting moment, you can go onto our Off the Ball Twitter account and actually vote for this. So Johnny's got the vote for Shane Long in there. I'm going for Shane Lowry. I do think Shane Lowry will go all the way.
Do you think Katie Taylor is going to win it? Think Katie Taylor is going to win it outright?
I think so. And I think it's an unstoppable juggernaut. I think it's a gold medal within this year, which transcended sport. I think people, like you say that golf is perhaps a sport that doesn't capture everybody's imagination. I think Shane Lowry was a bit of an exception to that at that moment. I think people had their ears pricked and were certainly found their way to their nearest television, perhaps come to Sunday. But if that's not true, then it certainly is true for Katie Taylor's case. I know it was in the middle of the day, but people would have certainly been keeping an eye on what was going on, that the country was...
Why did it transcend sport?
Okay, maybe it didn't transcend sport, but it transcended sport to people who weren't necessarily sports fans.
Is it not one of the most...
It's a gold medal bout.
But is it not one of the most peripheral sports in the world, like women's boxing?
But the Olympics is the exact opposite of peripheral. It's bang, right, front and centre during those few weeks. It doesn't matter what the event is. It really doesn't matter what the event is.
Katie is really loved in this country. I think that's fair to say, in that she's...
Oof. This is always how...
Who's she up against in the semi-final?
You're putting me on the spot here. I'm sure somebody in the box will tell me in a sec. I don't know who she's up against.
Who's Katie up against?
In the semi-final.
Do you think Katie will win it outright anyway?
I think Katie will win it outright.
Katie is a national icon. I'm not really a boxing person, though, I suppose.
Olympic champion, I've dreamed of this moment so many times before.
And that is that. That is Ireland's most memorable sporting moment of the decade. For this morning, we'll bring you the results tomorrow morning. Just a reminder,
competition, to be fair,
that the winner is from Mayo this morning of our competition. Conor McKeown is his name. And that brings us, before we wrap up this morning, to our final issue. So if you've just joined us, we had a bit of controversy earlier on and we prepared an official off-the-ball statement. So I can just been handed this and I've just been sent it here. I can now read out this statement surrounding the Mayo GAA saga.
Is this the first one off the ball?
This is a communicado aficionado or whoever Real Madrid pronounce these things. Controversy has obviously surrounded off the ball this morning, as we have been singled out by the Mayo County Board's public relations officer for our coverage of last month's emergency county board meeting at Elvery's McHale Park, Castlebar. We would like to take this opportunity to seriously apologise to the Mayo PRO, Mayo Gaelic Athletic Association and the Mayo people in general for the disservice we have done to their great administration. Now, Paul Kinnan, Braveheart, as his friends called him, delivered this rousing speech at the Mayo County Board Convention at the weekend. And I quote, "We had an instance during the year where a radio broadcaster sent a reporter down to a meeting and made a mockery of Mayo GEA. I mean, how dare you do that to us? How dare you treat Mayo GEA like that? for some content in social media to make an absolute fool out of us and how we do our business just because we were having an emergency meeting with our clubs. The GAA's version of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, I'm sure you'll agree. Like Boris Johnson, Mr. Kinnan roared to the top of the polls at the Mayo County Convention at the weekend, leaving his detractors looking very foolish indeed. He mentioned an unspecific journalist who posted a Twitter video that got 166,000 views in that speech. Now, I'm not sure if I was the only journalist who got 166,000 views that night, but I was the only journalist there, so I assume it was me he was referring to. I can only say that you and your county deserve an apology for me making a fool out of you. You deserve better. You were the man that played Shoot a Donkey at halftime in the Underdogs game, and you deserve better. You were the man that played Money, Money, Money at halftime in the Underdogs game, and you certainly deserve better. You're the man who was PRO of the county board that banned media from an emergency county board meeting and then didn't answer any questions afterwards. And you certainly deserve better. Congratulations on your re-election. The days of anyone making a fool out of you are well in the past. I'm truly sorry. See you tomorrow morning.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.